evening. Sorry for the delay. I'd like to call to order the City Council meeting of, or actually the study session of April 4th, 2017. Before beginning our study session for a Totem Lake Connector Bridge update, I'd like to announce that right after this session, the council will be going into executive session to discuss potential real property acquisitions. We expect to resume our regular meeting at approximately 7:30 p.m. If we could go around the table and identify ourselves for the record, please.
Jay Arnold.
John Pascal. Kurt Triplett.
Kathy Brown.
Toby Nixon.
Dave Asher.
Penny Sweet.
And Amy Wallen. Thank you very much. City Manager, here's a good topic for us to discuss.
Yes. So, thank you, Madam Mayor, members of the council. So, as you recall, in our recently adopted city work program, one of the key focus items was the bridges at the two ends of the Cross Kirkland Corridor, one the South Kirkland Park and Ride Bridge, and the other is the discussion item for tonight, the Totem Lake Connector Bridge that goes over Totem Lake Boulevard and 124th. So our CIP group, led by Aaron McDonald, has done a great job of starting our public outreach and working with the consultant to get some design concepts, and our goal tonight is to give the results of all that work, and then hopefully get some confirmation from the council of the concepts you'd like to see moving forward for further design. So, and we encourage lots of questions, and we're going to be walking around too and looking at some of the boards as we go through this presentation. So, with that, I will go ahead and turn it over to Aaron.
Okay. Good evening, Madam Mayor, council members, city manager, and esteemed colleagues.
You have to be at a microphone.
Oh, sorry. So I'd like to introduce our consultant, Sean Valdovinos, and he's with Cowie Incorporated North America. He was our selected bridge consultant, and I brought him here tonight to show you some of the work he has done, just to kind of give you a sense of who we hired and what they can do for us.
So with that.
Welcome, sir.
Yeah, well, thank you.
That goes up, too, since you guys are both tall. You can raise it. Right there.
All right, yeah, thanks. Aaron invited me here to just share some of my past experience and the company experience in pedestrian bridges. So I'll run through some of my projects just so you get a feel for what I've done in the past. I've had a pretty fortunate, well, as far as the team, let me just jump back to there. The team itself, we've got Coe as the prime consultant. I'm the project manager, design lead, and we have VIA Architects. And then for civil and public outreach, MIGSVR, along with trail design. Geoengineers is handling the geotechnical and environmental, and then survey is One Alliance. So COE is an international bridge firm, and it has a particular expertise in pedestrian bridges around the world. And North America, we have a pretty strong presence also. So myself, I've designed all types of bridges, transit structures, a lot of sound transit, elevated guideway, and then road bridges, of course, but have had this special opportunity to do a lot of pedestrian bridges. And I think the nice thing is they become very expressive as a structure itself. So I'll just run through some of my past experiences. So this one is a bridge up in Vancouver, BC, just north of Vancouver, Swamps Chief Pedestrian Bridge. Looking down on it, and then some of the details of the bridge. A beautiful setting with the mountains in the background, and this is designed to touch down lightly on the granite rock on both sides. And Howe Sound runs up. It's a beautiful fjord that runs up north of Vancouver. So this is a very simple structure, but very kind of pure in its form, and it sits nicely in harmony with the site. And just north of that, you can actually see this Squamish pedestrian bridge from the other bridge. Different projects, different timeline, but this one was at a First Nations reserve, so Native American in Canada again. The construction of the arches, it was a clear span over the roadway and the railway, and used three cranes in kind of an orchestrated lift, so it was a pretty neat night closure of the highway and railway. And then the opening ceremony with the view on the bridge. So there's a lot of cultural symbolism that was embedded in the bridge. And an artist was actually appointed to work with me on the design. And I created some opportunities for him to use these big thrust walls at the ends of the arch as canvases. So he put like a serpent on one side, the thunderbird on the other. And there's kind of a relationship with the natural topography. And this is how that came out. So it was a pretty neat bridge.
Question?
Yeah.
On one, you've got some pretty heavy screening.
Mm-hmm.
The other, you don't.
That's right.
I've always had a grudge against the authorities that required us to put up chain link fencing on the 100th Street overpass.
Right.
Is there a consideration that allows us to open the sides up?
Mm-hmm.
When can we do it, and when shouldn't we do it, or can't we do it?
Yeah, in this particular case, it was the railway. So the railway wanted the screening, and they typically also can take in consideration of the users. So there's elementary school kids, and they thought that they may be more apt to throw things on the tracks, whereas on the other side, it was a lot of hikers and rock climbers. So they tended, like, and that was just a highway, so the Ministry of Transportation was okay without it. There are different ways to do it. And this one, we had a pretty robust screening, but it was a galvanized fence integrated into the arch. That was the idea here. And then I think in our case, we're actually looking at no screening, given the users of the area.
Yeah, and when I've discussed this with our transportation manager, he had indicated to me that because of the speeds we have there, it's not a requirement, whereas if you are on a highway with the higher speeds, there's much higher impact. So currently, we're not planning on doing anything of that nature.
You're only required if you're in Kirkland. Bellevue doesn't have to do it for their bridges.
Yeah, that I can't speak to. With the ones over 405 were specified by the DOT, so they have a different viewpoint, I think.
Well, and this next one's actually interesting. I don't know if you can see it too well here on that screen, but the throw barrier is actually off the sides. It's cantilevered out. Mm-hmm. So it's over a railway, also the light rail, and they didn't want someone to throw something onto the catenary system. Mm-hmm. And so they cantilevered it out and actually used glass panels. Mm-hmm. So there are, it's a good point you have, so different ways to do it. This one's in Calgary as part of the expansion of the roadway for the LRT system, the light rail system here. Multi-use trail and integrated into the surrounding pathways. And then I've also worked on the two preliminary designs, the reference concept designs that are part of the EastLink project. And so those are crossing over 520. So we worked with Sound Transit, City of Redmond, Microsoft for the one bridge, and also WashDOT. So these are actually going to be built by 2020, maybe 2019.
Wow.
So they're in design now, final design. And then another bridge in Vancouver. This is the Harborside West Pedestrian Bridge. And this one had a lot of difficulties on the site. We had to get up and over that railway, a very flat site. And so to do that, we worked with the adjacent municipality and used their land to kind of like snake the bridge in the upper corner of their parcel. So that's a lot that they could potentially sell in the future. And we allowed access, and with this, there are lots of little considerations for bikes and peds alike. But the fabrication of the piers, they were done out of steel, turned upside down, set on these concrete pedestals, with a large observation deck at the top, and it overlooks the creek. And this is how it looks in use. So it's got that curvature and those tree supports that funnel the load down to the discrete foundations.
Beautifully done.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. And then another bridge in Calgary. This is a network arch, so a very slender arch bridge, about a 200-foot span. And it opened 2 years ago. And you can see the big scissors cutting the ribbon.
Wow.
And one of my favorite bridges that I had the opportunity to work on was a suspension bridge for the Boy Scouts of America. They had a major donation to buy 11,000 acres in West Virginia, adjacent to the New River Gorge National Park. And they set out to build this national camp. So spanning over a ravine, we designed this bridge as part of a competition. It's a suspension bridge, two piers, the main cables actually dip under the deck at mid-span. You can kind of make it out there. Yeah. And this is maybe a slightly better view where you can go up and over on top of the piers, and there's a big observation deck. You can go where the cables cross, you can go on and off those pathways. And then underneath, there's a big observation deck, which became the patch trading center for the Jamboree. And here's the usage of the bridge.
Oh, wow. Where is that?
West Virginia.
How high up is it?
It's about 100 feet over the valley floor from the dipping part of the cables.
That's cool.
And in this case, you can see the cable, the netting system. You can kind of make it out in the light. So this is a cable mesh, stainless steel, and it's used a lot in zoos and different things like that. So it's very strong. But it gives you a really nice transparency. So in the case of where you do need throw barriers or you want a very transparent railing that also doesn't allow anybody to fall through, this is a good option. And another bridge that we recently won in West Virginia, it's an 830-foot network arch road bridge. So I've set out the design for that, and this is actually going to be built in 2 years' time.
Looks like Lacan.
Mm-hmm. So that's a quick overview of my experience. And on the Totem Lake Connector, we've been applying a lot of, I think, quite unique designs. We set out the alignment in a way that could be utilized for all the options. So it's one consistent alignment, really focuses on user comfort, navigating the curve to get up over the roadway, minimizing impacts on the adjacent properties, and addressing all the adjacent power lines. So a lot of little considerations and nuances in there. And then we've come up with those concepts that you have in front of you out of a whole study. And, you know, there's a lot of different types of structures that you can apply to any site. And we went through a pretty extensive exercise, the architect, myself, and then narrowed it down to the most applicable for the site. And I think these are all great options. And there's a focus of constructability, too, that goes into each of these. So I'll hand it over to Aaron.
Go ahead and keep talking.
Oh. I think we have a question.
Just a question.
From Councilmember Pascal.
Sure.
So those are pretty impressive catalog of different bridge designs. And I'm just curious, just from your expertise, can you talk a little bit about, I guess, what were some of the costs of some of those different bridges and kind of what mostly impacts the costs?
Sure.
from your perspective as a designer?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I didn't put some of the reference concepts for these, and I maybe should have, because a lot of them had very strict budgets, and that's kind of where I've come from. Like, oftentimes a design build, the first bridge that I showed, the arches, that was actually a design build project where the contractor wanted to spend the least amount of money, and they wanted to put a beam, a box beam with faux arches. And I convinced them to actually use like true arches and suspend that deck and make it really light. And we had some sessions where they would ask a lot of questions, and they were very concerned about the risk. But when we did the cost estimate, it was basically the same. And there was really just a risk item. And once they got comfortable with that, they said, yeah, let's do this. Let's build it. And it all went right together. And I watched the whole fabrication process. It was out there on the construction side, and it was that bridge was probably, I don't know the exact number, but it was under $400,000. And the nice thing was, it's just that span over the road, and then the approaches are just gravel, and it was sited in a way that it could follow the natural topography. So that's actually one of the key things there, is if you can do the right type of structure for the site. We had the rock, so a pure arch is really efficient, right? And then talking to the wingtip bridge, it's an 800-foot span, or total bridge, with a 560-foot main span, so a very long, long bridge, and 15-foot wide deck with secondary walkways, so a lot of pedestrian loading. And again, we had amazing sandstone that was actually harder than steel at both abutments. So a suspension bridge there, we just anchored it straight in with rock anchors, and there was very minimal rock excavation, basically just concrete to cap it in, and that was $12.2 million. So a pretty long bridge, and wide for pretty low cost. And some of the others, actually Harborside, the one I received a comment on, the tree piers, that was actually $2.7 million. And it was a 13-foot wide bridge, 270 meters, so I got to convert that. It was about 900 feet long. And by kind of stacking that north approach, we used walls and fills and really minimized the structure again. So there's some strategy. If you can minimize the structure and do things that are easy to build, and the repeatability of it, like the tree piers, each one was identical, and we just used some shims to account for the curvature, and then the trunk got longer as it grew taller. So everything was standardized, and the contractor really understood that. And I'd say that at $2.7 million, that was built in 2010, so it's not that long ago. So it's just trying to find the right usage of material. They're all. I had a whole list that I put together before, but they're all in that range, like quite reasonable.
Okay, thank you.
What are $2,010 dollars now?
You know, it's funny because so steel prices they were quite high in 2008, and then they tended to peak actually in 2009. Oil was like $150 a barrel. And so there's actually like the construction material costs have gone way down since then, but the dollar like has actually inflated a bit. So it's an interesting time. So I'd say 2010 to now, it's probably a little more expensive. But I will say that the prices look like they're coming up again, and that's it's been kind of flat. But last year there was a little bit of a spike, so that's something we have to worry about. You know, when we forecast these things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God we got the queen.
Okay. What's our next move?
Okay. Thank you, Sean. Appreciate that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Sean.
Thanks.
So I asked Sean to come just to kind of give you a sense of the people that we've gotten into business with here and his expertise and his real passion for pedestrian bridges. So I hope that is provided a good introduction to what they can do and that they're really focused on this project and really want to help us achieve our goals. So with that, so we did some introductions there. What's upcoming here is I want to discuss the past and current project activities quickly. I want to give you a quick update on the open house, which was our open house number 2 that we had March 16th at the Totem Lake Justice Center. I want to talk a little bit more about some of the responses we've been getting on surveys and asking questions, and just kind of give you an update and ask for your opinions potentially. And then give you a quick preview of the upcoming project milestones that we're quickly hurtling towards. At any time, we welcome input from the council either now or later on when you think of questions, and we'd appreciate that. So with that. So we've been doing a lot of meetings here. Here's some of the past meetings just as a quick list. One I wanted to highlight was the Cultural Arts Commission. I've met with them twice now, and I think I'm meeting with them again here pretty soon. last time I met with them, I encouraged them to come out to the open house, and in fact, a couple of them did, and they were quite impressed by what we're doing, and after they did that, they had a much better understanding of what the project was and the role that they can play in it. Thinking about the bridge as art concept, that was proven to be a little bit hard for them to wrestle with because it's not something they normally think of. Another transportation meeting is coming up here shortly, and our third public open house will be coming up in April. So here's a list of the ones that I know of at this point. I got 2 of them tomorrow. One of the things I would highlight here is the Kirkland Youth Council. It's one of the things we found when we were asking about the ages of people attending is we had nobody in the 20 and below range. So we took the step to reach out to them, and I'm going to go talk to them and tell them about the project and encourage them to become involved because, in my view, they are the people we're building this bridge for. Excuse me. I've been sick recently.
So just to kind of remind you of some of the things we've seen already, the boards on the left, which are also represented up here, you have seen previously when I did the first update with you. What's been added since then are the boards on the right, and there's a couple of pictures bigger coming up after this, and those are also the ones that are right behind you, so I encourage you to look at those and ask questions if you have time. So one of the two new boards is the bridge concept study, and maybe I'll actually ask Sean to jump up for a minute and talk a little bit about this since he was kind of the lead on it, you know, what they're showing here and how we arrived at the five bridges that are highlighted on the left there.
Sure. So as I mentioned, you know, we went through a kind of a brainstorming session of what's possible at the site and looked at a lot of different things. So on the left-hand side, it's trying to summarize some of those range of ideas. So trusses, cable stayed, stress ribbon. These are all the different types of bridges. These are terms that you may not be familiar with, but like an arch. And then as you look at the kind of highlighted white boxes, those are the ideas that we started to settle on. We thought these are actually quite appropriate for this crossing. The unique thing about the roads kind of weaving together here, you get a different visual as you enter the bridge or come onto the bridge, you know, from the roadway from these different perspectives. So we really looked at a 3D approach to this. And then on the right-hand side, we've taken these kind of sketches, these as far as the ideas or the themes, like these sketches tend to kind of capture the essence of what that is trying to do. So we have the ribbon, the connective ribbon, which is a girder bridge, and this is probably the cheapest option. So you have two girders on either side of the bridge, and you can do some fun things like laser cutting into the sides to create some mosaics or words or whatever you want to do. And then at night, the lighting would tend to illuminate that, so kind of like a lantern effect. And it would touch down at the island and then kind of make its way across the roadway. But very linear. And we're looking at this as like the option that the CKC is a very linear element, right? So it builds on that idea. And then we looked at the gates, so these V-piers. And it's a series of identical V-piers, you know, towers, that hold the bridge at the each span over the roadway. And as I mentioned before, like the idea of kind of repetition, fabrication costs go down. And the idea with that is that the three Vs are the same. And then you just basically build the concrete pedestals underneath. And this has a lot of benefits from constructability. It also has this idea of procession. So as you move across that roadway, you pass through these gates. And then you get to the big kind of aha moment where you get to the loop ramp. And then there's a skipping stone. This is the idea of kind of linking Lake Washington with Totem Lake and really emphasizing the importance of the wetlands and water in the region. So the kind of undulating arches where it's below deck, above deck, below deck, above deck, it kind of skips across the roadway.
With that one, do you have to have the below deck? Or, I mean, could it be just the above deck arches?
It could be, and you could achieve it.
But it's part of the structure.
It was part of the theme. And what we try to do is utilize the areas that are, like, on the island. It kind of engages that as it's below deck over the island, above deck over the roadways, yeah. And then the approach spans, it's a bit more of a expression, if you will.
Yeah, no, I was just wondering if the structure, if those were more about the structure or more about the aesthetics.
Yeah, I'd say that it's having it reversed. It's still efficient structurally. It's just like you reverse the arch.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was an aesthetic consideration on that.
Could you touch the below deck archway down and eliminate the piers on the either side?
Yeah, we actually looked at that option too. We did, and we started to get a little concerned on that from susceptibility or vulnerability from traffic collision, because that island, you'd almost have to put like protection all the way around the island, right? Because it's exposed from every angle, and an errant vehicle could come at it, and if you hit the arch, that was the concern that we ended up having with that idea.
Right, you either hit the arch or the column.
Yeah, and the columns are going to be designed to, like, they're going to have the impact resistance is kind of the, yeah, yeah. So it'll be a reinforced concrete, and it should win the battle. You never like to see it, but, you know, that's the design approach. And then the half arches, this is actually a cable-stayed bridge, but it builds on this idea of an arch where it's quite efficient. And if you have an arch and you cut it in the middle, there's a compression in the arch. So if you replace that with a tension, that's what that upper illustration is kind of representing, you can replace that with a cable and remove the other half of the arch, and it's still stable, and then you can rotate that up. So it's a curved tower, but it's efficient. So it's a pretty unique structure, and then it's anchored at that back pier. So it's kind of a fun idea. And it's also like trying to build on that gateway idea. And then the last one is a very unique structure. And this is, we call it the suspended ring. And it really puts all the structure at the wetlands and creates an anchor point to the redevelopment of the lake, where there's kind of the loop itself is all anchored off of a single pylon or a mast that sticks up in the air and slightly inclined. And there's a cone of cables coming down, and then on each side of that cone it's sliced, and there's a looping cable that creates like a water drop. And so from the deck you could see through that portal, and this theme of water is then kind of reinstated in, you know, the skipping stone and this one. And then over the roadway it has a one-sided truss, so it has again an undulating top cord to kind of give this wave form, and it's only on one side, and then it's a box structure underneath that tends to resist the twisting action from load.
One side meaning above the plane, not
that's
side
right.
Meaning the left or the right.
So it's actually going to be just on the west side, the truss itself.
Oh really?
Yeah, yeah. So that one's kind of interesting.
Oh okay, cool.
And the reason for that is in the. There's a lot of details. It's hard to totally explain it, but I can do my best. In the ring girder itself, it's like the cone of cables are anchoring to the deck. So you have this deck, and if you hold it at the level, the edge of the deck, and then you load it, it wants to kind of flip on you. And so what we've done is we've got these little upstands along the inside edge, so the cable anchors to that and passes through the center of the deck. So then as you put the loading on this deck, it actually wants to stay level. So it's actually a structural purpose to it. So it's almost like an L shape at each of these cable points. And then those upstands become part of the truss. So there's this theme that's carried out from the the connection to the ground all the way up through the loop and across the road. And the sketch doesn't do it justice. There's a lot of thought that we've been working. We've actually got a 3D model now of that one, and I think with the renderings you can start to appreciate some of the nuances. So it's probably the most unique structure, and then that would probably be on the higher end, right? Girder to that, and I think the price tends to increase in the order we've put them.
Sean, if only you could find a job that you were really passionate
about.
We have a comment or question from Mr. Nixon.
So this design for the ring part of the bridge,
mm-hmm.
Is that exclusive only to this design, or could that be combined with the others in terms of how the ring is realized?
Yeah, we've looked at trying to apply that to the others. It's a little bit challenging because you think, you know, say in the skipping stone, you have this very nuanced kind of decay of that stone, right? Like you skip a stone, it tends to get shallower and shallower, and then the loop almost kind of represents the stone itself. And then if you punctuated that with that mast, it's kind of an awkward juxtaposition, yeah. You see. And so we've looked at different themes.
It's a splash.
It could be. And we've been toying with that idea. I know Aaron's mentioned it. We've looked at that. There is some constructability of how we've kind of rationalized the loop for each option, too. And the last one has a very unique box that goes along with it.
So most of these others, it's just pylons underneath?
Yeah, so it would be somewhat like the Harborside Bridge, where you'd have these, you know, more slender elements.
Right.
Supporting it at a regular interval. And we're thinking more like Y-piers that tend to have that trunk and branching up to support each edge of the deck.
Similar to the gates?
Similar, yeah.
The smaller?
Yeah, that's right. Yep. And they would be at each edge of the deck. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you, knowing what you know about the neighborhood and what we're trying to create, and you had, you know, money wasn't an object, which one of these would you like to build?
Well, I think the suspended ring is...
You like the suspended ring.
If you want a really iconic bridge and something that you haven't seen before,
yeah,
that's going to be the one.
Mm-hmm.
We've used that term before.
Iconic bridge, we have.
Now calling it landmark instead of iconic.
Yeah, and then I think the half arches are also, you know, in that category of, you know, it's unique in that it's, you don't normally see a curved tower, but it's actually efficient, and that's kind of the neat thing is when you find something that's not forced, but it's very expressive and pure, and I think those are, and the skipping stone. I mean, I like all of them. I came up with you know these ideas, but it's I think it tends to be anchored at the bottom of the page, I would say, in uniqueness.
Okay. What's next?
Next slide here, which is number two you see over there. The point of this one is to kind of,
The point of this one is to kind of set this process in context, but the real interesting thing that we wanted to show the public here was the various widths and also the idea that extra width doesn't come without a cost. So not knowing what the ultimate cost was going to be at this point, we show this to the public. We use dollar signs to kind of represent, 12 foot, which is our standard that we started with the CIP project with, as being $1, going to 14, maybe being $1.50, but going to 16 is not a linear progression. You end up accumulating more money because your foundations have to get bigger and possibly deeper, et cetera. And one thing I wanted to highlight on this that was really an interesting thing to me is the picture on the far right down below Frankfurt, Germany. Sean has told me that's the only bridge that survived World War II out of, 13? Well, it's one of the few bridges that survived the bombing in there, and we believe the reason was because it was not militarily useful. So why would they spend their bombs on it? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an interesting thing.
Show the widths over there.
Yep. So we'll get to that real quick. So when we had the open house, too, we had a few key questions we wanted to ask people or start getting some feedback on, number one being what bridge width did they feel was most appropriate. And to help them and both you kind of get a sense of that, I set up a little mock-up over here. You probably saw on your way in to show you what does 12 feet, 14 feet look like. Really hard when you try to think of that number. What does that actually feel like? I've gone around all our bridges around here in Kirkland and the trail down at the south end at 520 there, and that's the place where I found 14 feet wide, the trail at the south end on 520, and it's the side that heads eastbound. When you turn around and go westbound, it all of a sudden becomes 12 feet. Don't know why, but if you'd like to take a tour and go see what these things actually feel like to stand on and, you know, have some comments, we could certainly do that. I estimate it'd probably take about 2 hours to go see them all. I think there's like 8 that I picked up locally here. We also asked the question about of the 5 bridge designs that made it through the first cut here, what were their favorites? We also asked a question that was a separated question about values, and this would be the which one best expresses a gateway structure, which one best expresses a sense of place, and we asked them to tell us what their favorites were that met those goals there, or those experiences. So I have a number of graphs that kind of show you some of that stuff here. I cut it down to the absolute minimum and just really gave you the highlights. And the sheet that you have here in front of you, the colors will coordinate to those graphs, just to kind of give you a sense of when you're seeing green up there, which bridge are we talking about. So the first graph is just what we collected on the bridge width. So I don't know if this happened organically because we didn't plan it, but I had my little display at the Totem Lake Justice Center there, and people, we had dots for people to do some of our other exercises, and they just started accumulating over there. And the majority of them accumulated at 14 feet when people went over there. I didn't have a chance to talk to people at that point and find out. I don't know if you have any input. And it was not a huge data set. It was about 40 people that were there at the open house and voted on that, but a clear preference for 14 feet. And I have received the memo from COE et al. Here now, and that is the width they're going to recommend at this point. They believe that that will provide us the level of service we need today and in the future. The user level that we're projecting, that's plenty of width. One thing I'll say is at 14 feet wide, that's wide enough that you could delineate it with a center lane. If you wanted to actually go to physical lanes delineated for separate uses, you would need to go wider, and 16 feet appears to be the minimum. In talking to people about that, there's good things and bad things about that. The downside is when you create width, you also tend to create a sense of entitlement and can lead to some conflict and, possibly something we don't want out there. So if we wanted to go a little bit wider and give ourselves that option in the future, we certainly could. We don't have to put delineations down there at this time. But that's kind of a decision that we'll need to make at some point here before we settle on an ultimate width. But for all indications right now, 14 is wide enough for our purposes.
Comment.
Yes, sir. Mr. Asher.
I would think that whatever sideboard treatment we do would affect the perception of width anyway.
And this is the clear width. So the bridge itself might be 16, and you've got a foot for edges and guardrails and whatnot. So this would be the usable, we'll call it trail width.
Yeah, I assume you were talking more about the transparency.
Yeah, the transparency, the sense of confinement or openness, I think would lend materially to one's perception as they go across the bridge, whether it feels free or it feels like I've got to really scrunch up.
Yeah, and one of the design keys that we're looking at, I can't remember what CETP is, but it's the crime prevention design idea, whereas, we don't want to create something that's a box you can't see into or out of, so it kind of goes along with that idea. So the next one here is at the open house, we asked people to rank their bridge favorites here, and we took that data and put it together, and it was pretty clear that we had three top choices: the skipping stone, the half arches, and the suspended ring. We needed to kind of zero in on what the public was thinking here, so we talked internally about it, and we said, yes, those are all three good ones to take forward, because what COE is doing right now is they're taking these top three and going into a detailed design, which will verify the designs and also give us a fairly accurate cost. Is that pretty accurate? Yeah, because that's one thing we don't have right now until we start doing that work. So we also, not too soon after that, put a survey out online. We didn't quite get what we expected out of that survey. I wouldn't say we had an expectation, but it was a little unusual, and we got that back and found out that the top three had changed. I've been wrestling with this data for a week plus now here, trying to kind of figure out what's going on. One of the interesting things I figured out yesterday, of the 283 responses, 35 of them were duplicates. And in fact, one of them, somebody voted 17 times. So I pulled, I left their top. Well, I didn't look at that, but I looked at a bunch of them, and clearly they were not voting the same every time. They were all over the place. So I took the first one that they voted for each of those IP addresses and pulled the rest of them out. It didn't change the rankings at all when I did that.
Could have been a group home,
Yeah. Well, somebody pointed out to me today that there are two right in a row, and it's like maybe that's a husband and wife or whatnot. So, one of the things we learned is be careful about how you ask survey questions, et cetera. But it was a little bit of a problem. It's like, well, we used some data and we went forward with that. Now we're getting a completely different set. Why? One of the things that we're pretty sure of is on the first slide that I showed you, that was a smaller data set, about 40 people, we had a captive audience. We had all these boards here, and we were able to walk people through and explain the whole process to them and what we were trying to achieve. And then they did their voting, and there was two separate votes here. There was a vote for the bridge, which ones are your favorite, and a vote for the values, which of these bridges best meet your values, and that will become important here in a second. Online, we don't know what they did. They had all this information available on the website, but I don't know if they looked at it. I don't know if they just went in and did it quick because they were on their way out to dinner or whatnot, so we're not as confident of that data. But what I did to rectify that was I took the information we had about the values And, you know, they said which bridges best meet the values we're after, gateway structure, sense of place, or whatever. And I turned that into an adjustment. So I got some percentages out of that, which ones were really favored to, you know, or which bridges best met the most values, I guess, which were most highly rated. And I turned that into a percentage that I back applied to the other data that was a little bit wacky. And what I found was that when I made that adjustment, it came right back to my original survey set of 40 people. So the same three that we, you know, appeared to be the most favored ones came out of that. So one thing I'm looking for, I guess, is your feeling about how do you feel about going forward with that? Did you, you know, want to talk more about that? Do you want to try and do some more surveys and see what happens, recognizing that we could get a completely different result? And if you're not prepared to talk about it now, that's fine. We've got
Mr. Asher.
I don't understand the right chart, the right graph.
So the adjusted one?
Yeah. So it looks like the by the length of the or the height of the column, the first choice is lower. Is that not a qualitative? It has another factor in there than just a quantitative.
Yeah. Component. So when I went through and started parsing this data, I said, you know, what's the highest rated first choice? And it was the gray one, which is the skipping stone. That one's no longer available now to pick for the second choice. So it was kind of a deductive thing. And when you get down to number five, you're only left with one choice.
Okay.
So that's, yeah, it's kind of, it was really hard to represent this stuff. I said, I played with it for weeks and I had to cut it down to its bare essence, and hopefully I've done that. The question remains, you know, do we feel good about these three as the choices that we want to take forward through design or through the selection point, I should say, because at the end of this, we will have some vetted designs and we'll have some cost data and we will have more public input, and we will be coming to council and providing all that and asking for your opinion on that.
Yes, Ms. Sweet.
Are we going to have a process where we let people know what the top picks were?
Yes, when we go to the next open house, we will be bringing all this information forward.
Excellent.
So, yeah, we're not trying to hide anything, and we're not doing anything to the data other than adjusting it in ways that you can easily follow and, you know, are not value-based or anything like that. We're not putting our stamp on it. Just saying, here's what the data said, here's an adjustment I've made to try and make it understandable.
Then I'm comfortable moving on.
Okay. Mr. Pascal.
So we're using the input that we get from the public and the surveys to really hone in on the top three out of the five. And I mean, another way you could look at it, though, just kind of thinking, kind of, you know, as you go through this process, is you could look at what's the lower cost, what's the higher cost, and what's the middle. I mean, that would be another way, because we're trying to hone in on and shortlist these without all the information available. So that would be my only comment would be, I don't really understand the cost differential between the other two, because I mean, I don't think people are saying that connective ribbon was perhaps ugly or non-attractive. It just wasn't as as attractive as maybe some of the others. But I don't know that they were saying that it was a bad bridge necessarily.
Yeah, Sean relayed something to me. He had a few conversations, and correct me if I misinterpret or misstate that. When he was talking with people in these boards and they started looking at the connective ribbon, they asked that question kind of, which of these are the least expensive? Or they kind of honed in on that being the least expensive. When they went to the values question, which one best expresses a gateway sense of place, et cetera, they changed their mind. They kind of understood that it's not strictly just which bridge is less expensive or, you know, which one do I like looking just at the bridges. It's how do these choices also meet these other values? Is that an accurate representation?
Yeah, I think that was actually a common question, is like, well, how do these rank as far as cost? And a lot of people would actually state, like, I think you should build the cheapest thing. And then I would explain that, that the ribbon is the most economical, and then the gates are a little bit more. Skipping stone is about the same, and half arch is a little more, and then the suspended ring the most. And then I would ask them, so, well, you know, which one do you like the best? And they would oftentimes say the skipping stone or the suspended ring. And it was funny because they started out, like, oftentimes they started out, like, you know, this should be, you know, the cost should be the consideration. And once they spelled that out, then they would oftentimes still go with the more expensive options.
I guess, I don't know if you can give us a sense of order of magnitude. So if the ribbon one is one unit, then is the ring 2 units, 3 units, or 1.5 units?
You know,
big of a range are you talking about?
Yeah, I think that the gates and the skipping stone are very economical structures. Like I think they're actually they're not much more than the ribbon. They don't use a lot of material. They're easy to fabricate, easy to install. And we've actually started sizing members and putting costs to it. There's also the foundation aspect of it. Like we actually have really bad soils here. So trying to minimize the foundations and the size of those is another effort that we're going through. So they're not double, the connective ribbon, and I would say they're probably like it's hard to know. I did do a preliminary cost estimate though, and I looked at kind of the variation, and I would say maybe 20% or something like that, and then the half arches, again, it's the way you build it is actually pretty slick because you have precast panels, you put them out, and you don't have to close the road, you just keep incrementally placing those. And I can't speak to that one because we've just kind of gotten into the design numbers. And there is like the anchorage pier, and there's some, you know, it's complicated. And then I would say the suspended ring is all steel. And the idea is that you have like a epoxy surface for on top of the deck, and it's actually not a really complicated span over the road. Like we've got a 90-foot, 120, and a 90-foot, and it's a continuous span, so it's a truss. So we've made it rather efficient, and then the ring girder itself has this benefit that you don't have any foundations in the wetlands, and so there's one foundation that the pylon's supported on. Mm-hmm. And then the construction aspect of it, like I've envisioned that you have two temporary towers, you build pieces, and then you hang the piece out over the wetlands and stay it back to the mast and utilize the mast as a temporary element. And so I think that there's actually good benefit in the construction, and I'm quite interested to see how the foundations compare, because we have something like 6 foundations on some of the others in the loop ramp. You know, just shafts going down, like 5-foot shafts, and they're not that big. And we have one shaft in that loop. And once you put the materials to it, the reason I'm just hesitant is because of steel prices. If it was a year ago, I think that one would actually be quite competitive. And what we've seen is that steel has actually started to jump a little bit. And it's always a difficult thing because things can overshoot and then come back down. But it's gone up from the dollar it was, and Washdot's not quoting $2 for rebar. So it actually doubled for rebar in the second half of 2016. So that's a steel structure, and so it's basically hinging on the cost of steel. So there's a risk item to that. So that one's more expensive, and we're going to try to quantify that shortly.
Kathy?
So just a quick process check. We have just a few more minutes. And so we, you know, our thought was that we would narrow it down to 3 and move forward to a 30% design on 3 of them. We could do more, but that's more expensive and more time consuming. So getting back to Councilmember Pascal's question, we did kind of want to just get a feel from you. Should we narrow it down to 3 as we originally thought, or would you like us to do more work on all five, or are there four that you like? We can move ahead however you would like us to.
Mr. Asher?
Just a thought. The Gates proposal, which doesn't score that well in the surveys, loses on the profile view. And I just think that's the, you know, the competition is demonstrating the profile view, but it's sexy when you look at it down the trail, and I think the sculptural towers gives the capability for art installations that could really, I think, make it look nice. I'd be proud to have just about any of these, but that one to me was deceptive. From when I first looked at it, I like the tower. When you look down the tower view, I like that, but it doesn't pick up on the profile.
Other comments? Mr. Ryan?
So one thing I want to be aware of is there, in any design narrowing that we do, does that have other design implications? For example, one thing that we haven't talked about is some other elements of the bridge. For any bump outs or observation points looking over the lake or over the wetlands, can they be done with any of the designs that we're talking about?
Or widths.
Or widths.
Yeah, it accommodates. Each of them will have an opportunity. And actually, one of the ideas we've had is to have seating on the inside edge that kind of steps up. So when you go through the loop, like, the outside edge is actually where you're trying to contain if someone was to slip on a bike or something. That's actually like a safety concern if you had a sharp edge or something. But having it on the inside, it was actually kind of reversing the thinking of bump out but bumping in. And so say, like, in the cone, like with the suspended ring, you'd actually be inside of that cone but still seeing between the cables. A good opportunity there. And then the other ones we've also looked at, widening it on the inside edge so that you could have these kind of seating areas that people could linger. I think there's a lot of variety of ways to do seating and to kind of have these opportunities. And I think there's unique aspects for each design. And we would try to come up with the most appropriate methods for each design.
Okay.
We've already been brainstorming on it a bit.
Great. And then secondly, in some of the examples of the work that you have done, some of the pedestrian bridges were covered in our original concept, and the Cross Brooklyn Corridor Master Plan kind of appears that there may be some covered parts of the bridge. Mm. Was having a covered bridge something at all that was discussed could be done with these designs? Is that something you've asked the public about, whether it's important or not?
That has not been explored, nor have I read that in any of the plans I've looked at.
Well, and I can't talk to you. We talked to the Burger Partnership, and they actually talked specifically to that, and they said they didn't have a real purpose to those. They thought they could be lighting, and they actually commented on the designs that we've developed to date, and they were very excited about those opportunities. And we did discuss about the openness. So having kind of that transparency out to the wetlands is kind of a something we have discussed. We actually talk about it in actually this middle board right here, where we're having the loop, you're lifted up. And so it was really like this, like right now you can't see out over the lake very well when it's summer, but having that elevation view, you're going to see right out over it, and it creates a new opportunity. So that was where having a more transparent structure tended to lend itself. I mean, you could cover it, but
I report that maintenance was somewhat concerned about that, because it does introduce a fairly high maintenance cost. And know, when I think about that, you're up above traffic and you're trying to get out and exposed, you know, so imagine the experience of walking across and being exposed to the sky versus having something holding you in or over your head. So it's certainly a discussion we can have, but it hasn't risen to the top, and I am not aware of any of the public that has brought that up in any of our meetings at this point.
Yeah, I haven't heard
that. We
have
just a couple minutes left, and I have Ms. Sweet and Mr. Asher. It seems to me we have two decisions before us. One, do we think only three designs should proceed, and if so, which three? Is that right? Mm-hmm. How much more money does it cost to proceed with four designs, do you think? Ballpark? $1,000? $10,000? $50,000?
Here's three.
Quick response, if possible. Sorry to rush you now.
So is it on me? Okay.
Yes, it's
on
you.
So yeah, I think I've been thinking about this a lot since Aaron kind of mentioned it. I think it was yesterday, and we've been strategizing it. And I've talked to Via; they're producing the boards, and I've talked about it internally. So if say we added the gates, and I think I also heard that maybe the gates is the fourth one to add. We actually could do that, I think, quite reasonably fast and fit it in before the next open house. It would just be a matter of adding personnel to help create the extra work, do the extra cost estimates, and get everything done. And I know I gave you a quote, but I think it's actually going to be less than that when I look at these values. So I think
how much? Remember what the number was?
Can you ballpark it?
So $50,000 would cover it.
$50,000.
Yeah, and
okay, so maybe we should just choose three. I'm thinking. I don't know what others think.
Are you saying $50,000 additional?
Yeah.
An add-on $50,000.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's go with three, but I'd like to include the gates.
Okay. Yeah. So let's hear from everybody. I have Ms. Sweet, then Ms. Drasher. It made the threshold decision. We're only going to choose three. So you've got the gates, and which others?
The two top ones.
No
glasses.
Just do one, two, three.
The suspended ring.
Okay, so yes. You're cutting out the half arches.
Correct.
Got it. Okay. Mr. Asher?
I had a question before but one is lighting on these. I don't think we've talked about lighting. Are we expecting the facility to be lighted or not?
We haven't talked a lot about it yet. There's the option to light it or not. We definitely have provisions. I think if you light it, we've talked about like low-level lighting, handrail lighting that kind of illuminates the deck, and then accent lighting, and in a way that doesn't distract drivers. And actually, lighting is another opportunity for the Arts Commission, so they may want to have a lighting artist brought on for the second phase. There are lots of opportunities with lighting, and I think we definitely have that ability with any of these.
Yeah, okay.
Which do you like?
I like number two.
Yep.
Number three and number five.
Okay. Mr. Nixon?
Three, four, five.
Mr. Pascal?
I would do the 2, 3, 5.
2, 3, 5.
I'm sorry.
Oh.
Wait, no, that's correct. That's correct. That's correct. I'm sorry.
Just a joke there. Mr. Arnold.
And I appear to be the only one that likes the arches. I'd say 2, 4, 5.
I like the arches too.
I had 4 in mind.
It's not going to happen. 4 or 5.
I really like the Sundial Bridge question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it looks like it's going to be number 2, number 3, and number 5.
Yay.
The skipping stone, the gates, and the suspended ring.
Okay.
Although they were all lovely, as you can tell. We wanted them all. So, any other business for us before we go into our executive session?
Find a place in the city to drill each one.
Exactly.
Just a quick question. Yes. Are you comfortable with the 14 feet after looking at this?
Yes, I think so. Well, I didn't
just
hear
a quick question. Yes, so when you come back, will you have different kind of angles of viewing
definitely.
So that we can see the plan, the profile, the you know, just how it all how it looks. Kind
yeah.
of
no, it's a little tough to vote on this. So next round we'll have like renderings to a pretty reasonable level that give you all these perspective views in the context.
And Aaron, as you're doing future public meetings, are you continuing to ask folks their preferences among?
Yep. Yep, we're developing a standard set of questions, and as I get these renderings, I can certainly share those with you before we get a full set so you can get a preview.
Thank you. Yeah, if it's costing $50K per profile, I want 3D all the way under the 24 hours a day.
Did I see you had a comment, Mr. Nixon? Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. Beautiful work.
Thank you.
Exciting.
Thank you
very much. Thanks for the opportunity. This is a fun one. So we're going to go into an executive session to discuss property acquisition, and we will return at approximately 7:30. Thank you. The doors are locked to the cameras. Good evening. We are back in session following a study session on the Totem Lake Connector Bridge also an executive session to discuss potential property acquisition. Councilmember Marchione will not be able to attend tonight's meeting. So before asking Ms. Anderson for the role, I'd like to ask for a motion to excuse Councilmember Marchione.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. It was moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Deputy Mayor Arnold to excuse Councilmember Marchione. Is there any discussion? Thank you very much. Will all those in favor please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And those opposed say no. Thank you. The motion is approved. Ms. Anderson, would you call the roll for the regular meeting, please?
Here.
Member Pascal?
Here.
Councilmember Asher?
Here.
Councilmember Sweet?
Here.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Here.
Mayor Wallen?
Here. Thank you very much. The first item on our agenda is under honors and proclamations. It is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and we're going to recognize that. City Manager.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Mayor, members of the council. So, as I just had a chance to find out, the good news is now that so many councils are declaring this to be Sexual Assault Awareness Month that all the members of the group are not here tonight to receive that. They're at other council meetings. So here to receive the proclamation is going to be Leslie Miller, our Human Services Administrator. And they chose to go other places because Kirkland has a long history of supporting this issue and awareness for it. So we're very proud of our history. And once again, we'll be proclaiming this Sexual Assault Awareness Month.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Sweet is going to read this proclamation with me.
A proclamation of the City of Kirkland designating April as Sexual Assault Awareness Month in Kirkland, Washington. Whereas sexual violence is widespread and impacts every person in this community, and whereas rape, sexual assault, and sexual harassment harm our community, with the probability that 1 in 5 women and 1 in 71 men will be raped at some point in their lives, and whereas child sexual abuse prevention must be a priority to confront the reality that 1 in 6 boys and 1 in 4 girls will experience a sexual assault before age 18, and on campuses, 1 in 5 women and 1 in 16 men are sexually assaulted during their time in college, and whereas in 2016, 57 Kirkland residents' lives were changed through King County Sexual Assault Resource Center services, and whereas we must work together to educate our community about sexual violence prevention, to support survivors, and to speak out against harmful attitudes and actions, and whereas prevention of sexual assault requires the entire community to get involved and take action to create a safer environment for all. Now, therefore, she, Amy Wallen, Mayor of Kirkland, does proclaim April as Sexual Assault Awareness Month and joins advocates and communities across King County in taking action to prevent sexual violence, and furthermore, proclaim that each day of the year is an opportunity to create change for the future. Signed this fourth day of April, 2017, Amy Wallen.
This is such an important issue because I think there's so much shame around it that the more we talk about it, I think the better. So I really appreciate the council's support in this proclamation because it's a very important issue. The next item on our agenda is under communications. It's items from the audience. This is the time in our meeting when we hear from the public on matters which are not quasi-judicial or otherwise scheduled for public hearing. There are no public hearings scheduled this evening. So we ask that you limit your comments to 3 minutes, and we also ask that not more than three people speak on any one subject. However, if both proponents and opponents wish to speak, then up to three proponents and up to three opponents may address the council. And we do not have a sign-in sheet, so I'm just going to invite members of our audience if they'd like to come forward and speak to the council this evening. Is there anyone who wishes to address the council? All right, I'll declare this items from the audience period closed. The next item on our agenda is the consent calendar. And before we have a motion, I'd ask Deputy Mayor Arnold for an audit of the accounts.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. We have payroll in the amount of $3,094,595.51 and bills in the amount of $4,637,597.60.
Thank you, sir. Is there a motion to approve the consent calendar? Yes, sir. Mr.
Madam Mayor, I move first and final reading of the consent calendar.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Councilmember Sweet to approve the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? We have ordinances here, so I'd ask Ms. Anderson for the roll, please.
Councilmember Nixon?
Yes.
Councilmember Pascal?
Yes.
Councilmember Asher?
Yes.
Councilmember Sweet?
Yes.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Wallen.
Yes. Thank you very much. The consent calendar is approved. The next item on our agenda is item number 10 under unfinished business. It's the 2017 State Legislative Agenda number 6, City Manager.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Mayor. So this is our latest update from the state legislature, and here to provide that is, once again, our Intergovernmental Relations Manager, Lori McKay.
Good evening. For the record, I'm Lori McKay, your Intergovernmental Relations Manager. This is your sixth update. They never end.
they will.
I know. On the screen here, you have the session cutoff calendar showing that the legislature is in the final stretch of the regular session. The cutoff for bills to move out of their fiscal committees was today. Next Wednesday, April 12th, is the last day to pass bills in the opposite chamber. At that point, for the final 10 days, lawmakers and the governor will duke it out over the budget. And we have lots at stake in that process as we go forward. The word on the street is that they will not finish their budget on time on April 23rd. And they will go into special session or sessions. Does council have any questions on the calendar, on the cutoff calendar?
No questions on that.
Okay. So here is the summary table showing the current status of our...
Excuse me. Just one comment. Back on the calendar, it talks about passing bills out except those necessary to implement the budget. Several that we are interested in are necessary to implement the budget that we're tracking. So it doesn't have to be a budget necessarily to still stay alive after the cutoff.
Correct.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Basically, this is a summary table showing the current status of our priorities. What's not shown up there, just to be clear, is originally we had REIT 1 flexibility on our legislative agenda, and that went away during the first cutoff back in mid-February. And then also the city's priority to create a pathway to predictability on fines for jurisdictions that made good faith efforts to comply with the public records requests. That also died in the first cutoff. So that said, as we enter into the final 2.5 weeks here, the remaining aspects of all 7 priorities are shown here, and they're all in pretty good position. So starting at the top of the table with the priority of homelessness and affordable housing, those priorities are reflected in 3 bills, 1797, which is the Housing Local Sources Bill, sponsored by Representative McBride. 1570 is the document recording fee bill, standalone bill, sponsored by Representative McCree. And then Senate Bill 5254, which is the Senator Fain's buildable lands bill, and it contains the document recording fee and also REIT2 flexibility. All three of these bills, as Councilmember Asher just said, have been deemed necessary to implement the budget, which is that NTIB acronym on the screen. The Buildable Lands Bill 5254 was moved out of Senate Ways and Means to Rules last week. And again, they're all teed up for the budget discussions. Moving on to the city's MPD bill, which would lower the taxing limit for MPD facilities. The update here is to recognize that the House version of that bill, Representative Kloba's version of the bill, is not shown here. It died last week in the Senate committee. So our focus is getting the Senate version 5138 passed. The House Rules Committee placed 5138 on second reading last Friday, so it's ready to go to the floor as soon as it can get pulled to the floor. There was an amendment proposed to the bill last Friday that would remove the word parkway from one section of the bill. We reviewed it five times. And let folks know that we're okay with that amendment. So then looking ahead to the public records, our priority for updating the Public Records Act, language exempting non-appointed volunteers from some disclosure requests was amended into House Bill 1594, which is Representative McBride's bill on improving public records administration. That bill was heard in Senate Ways and Means last week, and then the committee took action yesterday to move it forward. An additional amendment was proposed to further clarify the volunteer language, and that was proposed by WCOG yesterday. And Kirkland indicated that the city is okay with that amendment as well. And I'd like to just recognize and thank Mayor Wallen and Councilmember Nixon for reaching out to Senator Rossi to help move that bill out. And I'm not sure if either one of you have anything you want to add here about that bill.
Well, I can just say that there were a couple of issues raised with 1594 after it was voted out of Ways and Means. But agreements have already been reached, and there's going to be a floor amendment to deal with it. And hopefully that's the last thing. I'm doing my best to make it the last thing.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. And we appreciate that, sir. Thank you.
Okay, so House Bill 1595, which includes a provision for allowing a nominal fee for electronic records, has been placed on second reading in Senate Rules, and it's ready to go. Moving on to the priority of replacing the property tax cap, House Bill 1764 was the House Finance Committee finally took executive action on this bill last week, and then this afternoon it was passed on to the Rules Committee, so it too is teed up for the budget discussion. And then I want to report here that Mayor Wallen took advantage of two opportunities to discuss this revenue option with Governor Inslee late last week, and then also with the governor's senior staff yesterday in Olympia. And also at both of those meetings, Mayor Wallen was able to raise Kirkland's concerns with current budget proposals around, for example, the next priority, which is the Basic Law Enforcement Academy funding, because currently the Senate's proposed operating budget funds 8 classes for the Academy, but it provides no funding for the 2017 supplemental budget, whereas the House budget, the House operating budget proposed funds 6 classes and then also fully funds the 2017 supplemental. So we'll see where the pending budget negotiations and the legislature land on that, and we'll continue advocating for funding in both the new budget and the supplemental. And then on this, the CKC-RCC regional trail connection, that's in the capital budget realm. The House proposed capital budget is expected to be released tomorrow. But meanwhile, back in the Senate did include the city's funding request of $1.4 million in their capital budget. So there were lots of cheers coming out of my office, and I think out of Councilmember Pascal's email and Arnold's email also to me, letting me know that that had happened. So that's a good thing. We'll know more tomorrow, whether we have to fight to get it in the final budget or whether we can help make it just stay there. Also in the capital budget, the Senate capital budget included $104 million for the Housing Trust Fund, which is up at the top of your table there. Then finally, on the TOD at Kingsgate Park and Ride notion, with the help of Representative McBride, the possibility of exploring transit-oriented development up at Kingsgate got a little bit of attention through Joan's persistence of getting a proviso included into the House transportation budget. The proviso has no funding, but it calls for DOT to investigate opportunities for a transit-oriented development pilot project at the existing Kingsgate Park and Ride. The proviso also calls for the department to coordinate with the city of Kirkland and other stakeholders to determine the feasibility and cost of TOD there. And then it also calls for a report on the process and outcomes that would be due to the transportation committees in the legislature by December 1st, 2017. So it's not certain if that's going to make it into the Senate budget, but it's definitely a welcomed assist by Representative McBride. And she also has requested a meeting with Secretary Millar to talk about this concept. And also WashDOT staff have told her that they'll get a preliminary report to her in the next 5 weeks. So that's my update.
That's an excellent update. Comments, questions for Lori? Mr. Escher.
Thanks. Everyone here should be very proud of all the efforts, and it's not everybody's involved in it, from the staff that are reviewing all of the myriad of bills. Kirkland is actively engaged, and to have the successes, the potential successes, knock on wood, that we're having in a session that the only thing that's going to get done is McCleary. This is amazing. So thank everyone that's pulling on this rope. We are actively engaged with the state, and they know we're there. So thank you for all that are participating.
And thank you for your leadership, sir. Thank you, Lori.
Thank you.
Great report.
Thank you.
The next item on our agenda is 10B under unfinished business is the Edith Moulton Park reject bids. City manager.
Okay, thank you, Madam Mayor. So, since it's fairly unusual for us to ask you to reject bids, we did have bids came in substantially higher than our engineer's estimates. We wanted to have a chance to walk the council through it and get your rejection, and then, which we don't seek very often, and let me rephrase that. But here to give you the presentation is our capital project supervisor, Rod Steitzer, and the project engineer who's overseeing the project, Brian Baker.
Good evening.
Thank you, City Manager. Good evening, City Council and Madam Mayor. I have a few brief slides to go along with your memo packet. The project overview consists of park improvements and frontage improvements along 108th Avenue Northeast. It is located in North Juanita and shares a border with Helen Keller Elementary School. At the end of this presentation, we will be requesting that City Council takes action to reject all bids. We separated the work into four schedules to aid in the project award. Some elements in Schedule A include lawn restoration, new children's play equipment, Juanita Creek trail and boardwalk system that is ADA accessible, and a fenced off-leash dog park. Schedule B is essentially the right-of-way improvements on 108th Avenue. These elements are a 5-foot-wide concrete sidewalk, asphalt parking with two ADA stalls, and striping for a bike lane. Schedule C is, Schedule C is a 40-foot picnic pavilion. Schedule D is a new restroom as well. The funding was provided by 2012 Parks Levy and Impact Fees. This allows the Park Master Plan to be adopted in 2015 with a total budget of $2.1 million. The design and permitting were completed in 2016. We advertised and opened bids on March 1st, 2017. 8 companies were registered plan holders, of which 2 companies submitted bids, with the low bidder being $800,000 higher than the engineer's estimate. The boardwalk was a large contributing factor to the cost disparity, about $457,000. The play area also had a large difference in cost, $65,000, and the restroom had a $59,000 cost difference. We had follow-up conversations with companies that didn't bid to try and figure out essentially what happened. The general consensus is there was too many projects available to bid and the market was very busy. A few contractors expressed concerns over building the boardwalk in sensitive areas and didn't think they could be responsive. We request that the City Council takes action and rejects all bids. This will allow us to evaluate cost impacts on the current boardwalk design, separate additional elements into separate bid schedules, provide a longer bidding period, and rebid in the fall.
Questions for our staff? Thank you very much, Brian. Mr. Nixon, Mr. Asher?
So I know that sometimes when you chop a project up into lots of little pieces, you end up with more overhead than you would have, mm-hmm. and that contractors, when they mobilize people to come on a site, it might actually save money to have them do multiple schedules. Do we allow people to bid across multiple schedules and say, if we got all of these, it would be this much lower? Is that part of the process at all?
Yeah. One of the strategies here is we would take a look closely at all the schedules and see what kind of advantages we could gain by packaging them together. Okay. And it's exactly the advantage you're pointing out. If you can find some commonalities between those schedules, put them into one package, there's, you know, a likelihood of some cost savings there.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Asher, then Ms. Sweet.
I just have a motion, so if you want to go ahead and pick up a question.
Ms. Sweet?
My question is, there a cost associated, or have you figured out a cost to associate with the creation of the dog component?
The separate schedule has the dog component. Do we have that cost?
Do we have it on us right now? Or have we evaluated if we do not? I don't understand your question.
I guess my question is that an element that we could proceed with separately?
Yeah.
One of the strategies that we'll bring back later when we do the bid is to have that as a separate component. And when we receive the bids on that, we'll know the costs and compare those to the estimated costs. And we can bring back options of what can be done to move forward with the dog park or move forward without it and maybe present that at a later time.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Pascal.
Thank you. Just a few questions about the bidding climate. So you said that, I mean, in the memo it said that basically there was, you know, too many things going on where we couldn't get enough folks to bid on it. But when you look at the costs, I mean, the costs were quite a bit higher than the engineer's estimate. Are we going to be re-looking at the engineer's estimate as we take it out for bids again? And do you see that changing or going up because of the big difference?
Yeah, one of the things that we're going to be looking at is not only the time of year that we're going to be putting this out, but the materials to be used. Okay. And if there's any strategies of packaging it in such a way that it'll appeal to a different type of contractor. The types of contractors that might do vertical construction may not be the best to do things such as the boardwalk. The boardwalk's going to involve some kind of piles and those kind of things. So we're going to take a look at what those costs are, what cost strategies can be looked at there and gained, and then put those packaged together for rebidding.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I've been hearing loud and clear as I started my time here is that parks projects are getting more and more expensive, and we're not able to, you know, meet some of the estimates that we were originally planned for. And so
is there a way to kind of look at all the parks projects and look at some value engineering so that we can, you know, be more assured in terms of what we can really do with the money that we have?
Yeah, and not to take too much more time here, but we're internally looking at those strategies of we're having Public Works and Parks come together, and with the consideration that we're looking strategically at how could you package these projects to get the most accurate estimates together. Maybe it's a phasing approach, you know, taking them to a certain level of design, right, and then looking at what the funding would cost for construction, time of year, permitting, grouping various projects together for permitting. Those are all things that are circulating around internally, but we'll bring those forward as we evaluate those and gain new information.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Asher.
Madam Mayor, I'd like to move to reject all bids for the Edith Moulton Park Improvement Project and authorize the staff to further evaluate, rescope the project, and re-advertise for new contractor bids later in the year.
Second.
Thank you. It's moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Councilmember Pascal to reject all bids. Any discussion? Well, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
And those opposed? Thank you very much. The bids are rejected. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Rod.
Thank you.
We appreciate your work on this. The next item on our agenda is under new business. It's the 11A, management of Jasper's Dog Park, with K-Dog sadly disbanding. City Manager.
All right. Thank you, Madam Mayor. As we reported to you, the K-Dog Group, having faithfully executed their five-year lease running Jasper's Dog Park and having done a phenomenal job, has said that they aren't able to continue to provide that service. We did want to ask the council if we could bring them back and do some celebration of the work that they have done for the first 5 years sometime in the future. But we also had a discussion of then what should happen to the park since they're no longer going to be able to take it over. And there was a discussion with the park board as well. So here to present you with the park board recommendations and also a discussion is Jason Filan, our parks operations manager.
Welcome, Jason.
Hey, good evening, Madam Mayor and members of council. I didn't have this nice and potted up and minimized, so I need to find it on the network here. I apologize for the...
No worries.
I thought I was going to be on a little down. Pondering Jasper's down here. Park. Here.
Is it here?
Is it?
Maybe that's where I got...
No,
that's
not. Got okay, moved. That's on the still. Desktop. Okay, let's see.
So walkable Kirkland's not about the dogs. It's about...
Yeah, it's part of the exercise, but not quite...
Exactly.
Not quite the ask today. Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
There we go. Thank you.
I will have a little brief update about off-leash areas and the K-Dog Group, and at the end... have a time for questions. A little background, go back a few years, we didn't have an off-leash area. Quite a bit of conversation in the community about the lack of an off-leash area. Council actually directed and we were able to form a Dogs and Parks Committee back 2003-2004. And from the fruits of their conversations, there was actually a resolution the council provided four off-leash areas, which included program elements like the one at Edith Moulton. When we developed park master plans to try to incorporate off-leash areas within those. Additionally, there was guidance from council on if there was a group that was to champion an off-leash area, some pretty specific information on how to go about that. With interaction with park board and a public hearing, involvement of our neighborhood associations, and then setting it up so that the cost would be incurred by the group, either via user fees or donations or volunteer stewardship. There was a group, the wonderful group of K-Dog, Kirkland's Dog Off-Leash Group, that formed in about 2009 and just did a great job of... galvanizing and getting support and energy around having Kirkland's first off-leash area. And in 2011, Jasper site was dedicated and opened. KDOG, we did have a memorandum of understanding with the group, and it was all-inclusive to fund, design, construct, operate, and maintain. Some of the details that KDOG and the group have been doing over the last 5 years is just everything, and they've been phenomenal. Keeping the park safe and clean and picking up and providing mutt mitts and incurring all the costs that are associated with operating a site like that. They've had volunteer parties every year that spread the mulch and even partnered with our Green Kirkland program and provided resources to keep the wetland, try to keep it invasive free. So with all those nice compliments, they did mention after their 5 years of the last 5 years of commitment that they were going to disband, which so we looked at what it would cost us as a Parks and Community Service Department to operate that at that level at which they'd been managing. So it's about a 20-hour week proposition. We looked at it from a half-time FTE benefited, all the costs that they had shared with us that were average costs over the last 5 years. On average, 40,000 to 50,000 patrons visit the park each year. With that, we started to look at what might be some interim solutions. The awesome thing about KDOG has been such a good steward of their resources, they actually have monies to partner. So at last month's park board meeting, we shared the information with our park board, and they had some recommendations for the council. First was to accept KDOG's donation and partner with them on a pilot program for 17 and 18. Obviously not the best timing right now, just passing the buy-in budget. So this is kind of like a punt, so to speak, for the next year or 2 years, basically. During that time, take a close look at exactly what the costs are, what it costs to maintain it effectively at how KDOG's been doing it. Also, pursue conversations with the Kirkland Parks Foundation and KDOG on some permanent funding opportunities that might be out there. KDOG has done a great job of generating resources via donations and people that are passionate about off-leash areas. And the last suggestion was possibly utilizing pet licenses resources, which I didn't say that too loud. Yes. Part of the
question for you, Jason.
Sorry.
Mr. Asher.
Does that mean the Parks and Community Services wants to take on the animal control function?
No, not at all.
So let me jump on and go back, if you wouldn't mind, Jason, for that slide for just a second. If I could clarify, so the Park Board made a recommendation to have the council consider adding a surcharge on animal license fees when Kirkland took over providing animal services in January of 2018. The staff recommendation would be not to evaluate that, at least not in 2018, a surcharge, because obviously we're converting and convincing folks who are currently paying King County to pay the city of Kirkland for animal license fees. So we don't think it would probably be appropriate for us to increase that fee or put a surcharge on it first. There is always the possibility that we would have excess funds from the animal license fee. The presentations we've given you that shows us taking over animal license, animal services, shows there might be a bit of a surplus. So we obviously won't know until we try. But there is nothing that prevents us from using some of that money for supporting something like Jasper's Dog Park. But that's part of the recommendation for the park board that the staff would say is not to explore in the short term is doing a surcharge, but keeping an open mind on whether some of the license fees could be used to support the park if there's more than enough fees that provide all the other services that we've promised. So we wouldn't make a change in the way animal services is provided, at least not now.
That was a great explanation.
So for many years, I've been advocating for off-leash dog areas, and I never have had the impression that we didn't have the ability to fund it without some kind of a surcharge or extra funding source.
So that's actually a conversation that's been going on with the park board for a while about having small pieces of existing parks that would be available off-leash either certain times of day, like maybe just in the morning, or all day, but only in certain places. And you might put up a fence or something, but you wouldn't encircle the whole thing with a fence. So in those scenarios, the assumption is essentially that our current maintenance staff would then still be providing maintenance, but that's something we'd have to look at and see whether there was a larger-than-expected impact of those parks. So we were going to propose those as a pilot, and I think that was going to come back to the council in 2018 to pick a couple parks and try a couple pilots of off-leash dog areas. But to maintain a dedicated dog park is a significant maintenance issue, particularly picking up after the animals and maintaining it. So that has been done entirely by the volunteers in KDOG at this point, and we haven't budgeted for that. So that's the significant source of challenge we're facing right now, to take over a dedicated dog park.
Mr. Arnold?
One thing that I don't want to lose in what we're hearing from the park board is the opportunity to engage pet owners in this this challenge that we have. And while I agree with the staff recommendation that a surcharge doesn't make sense, I do think that as we're setting up our new animal control, animal services and licensing, that there's the opportunity to ask for an additional donation. When you do your car tabs, there has in the past been an opportunity to donate to Washington State Parks or to buy a Discover Pass. And as we set this up, I would like to see explore opportunities to have folks contribute at the time that they are renewing their animal license fees. And I think that may be a chance to not only get some revenue, but also start to make people aware that maintaining this really popular, well-loved facility is taking some extra cost, and I think we can get some support behind it.
Thank you. Ms. Sweet?
I just thinking about that, I guess I would counter that I'm remembering a number, visits to the dog park, 27,000?
It's like 40 to 50.
Okay. But it's also a fairly unique community. I mean, it's a community that continues to come back over and over again. I would be more inclined to look at something like, you know, accepting donations at the door or keying the door somehow so that you could look at a way that the actual users are going to support it rather than to ask anybody to mess with their license fees at a time when we're making significant changes in animal control. I would feel more comfortable separating the two issues if we were to think about anything.
Excuse me.
Okay. Mr. Triplett.
Just to clarify, so in the recommendation that's before you, one of the things we would do is come back with a list of those kinds of options for further discussion by the council, so you don't have to decide today which ones you would do or wouldn't do, but we want to make sure that we look at everything that we could think about. So the being able to take their donation gives us time to figure out different proposals, which could include any of those.
Okay, we've got Mr. Asher.
Just to provide some historical context, the institution of the policy for off-leash dog area was a significant emotional event for the city of Kirkland. It took multiple years. If we are to materially change things, the owners of those 40,000 visits will occupy this room from probably multiple times because they are not weak-willed individuals that will just go away, speaking from experience. So I think it's a very sensitive area. It was calculated to be a self-sustaining additional level of service that was, we were having some incompatibilities with children in our parks and dogs in our parks. And that was, there were some fundamental challenges in both of those. So this is not going to be a quick or easy situation to readdress. And I think we need to try to find some way to reengage. I hate to suggest beginning to challenge what's out there, the status quo, but we need to raise people's interest, because KDOG is pretty much, it has devolved to the same people doing the same thing again and again and again, and as most volunteer organizations, they've just gotten tired, and I can appreciate that. So reviving this is going to take some bandwidth, and you'll all be involved.
Yeah, there's definitely a reason why the location is within a wetland, in a dry arable wetland. It was the only place that we could find some acceptance. It was challenging, to say the least.
Yeah. Question for Mr. Pascal?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I very much support this pilot program, exploring, you know, how we might permanently maintain Jaspers. I was just thinking, as part of, you know, this pilot program, can't we examine, just, I recognize that volunteers were taking on the full task of maintaining the park and doing everything, but are there some components where we could consider still recruiting volunteers for certain things, and could that be looked at and explored as part of this program?
Oh, for sure. There's some wonderful, passionate people that attend that place every single day. It's just that at the president, treasurer, executive level, it's really challenging.
Yeah,
I mean, people are busy. So there's definitely that conversation, and that's part of the pilot program, is to really take a close look at other creative opportunities that we could do to keep it going, for sure.
Great.
Okay.
Is there anything else I could answer?
Do we have any other questions? Nice. Okay.
One last comment.
Yes, sir.
Too, that at the park board, there was actually members of KDOG and the Parks Foundation, and one of the issues that the KDOG folks raise is that they still have some capacity to raise money. It's just providing all the volunteer hours, and the Parks Foundation was also interested in raising money. So they committed at the park board that they were willing to be part of a fundraising effort. So we're going to be reengaging them after these discussions pretty quickly and see if we can, you know, find a way to keep bringing in private money and commitments from those folks.
Thank you. Mr. Arnold and Mr. Asher.
Okay. I'm glad to hear at the beginning of your presentation that you mentioned bringing the folks from KDOG back. As Councilmember Asher has reminded us, this was hard to do in the beginning, and it's an incredible success story of the community coming together to build Jasper's Dog Park and to run it for the last 5 years. Given the cost, Jason, that you've mentioned, this is over $300,000 worth of work that KDOG has given the city, and I'm glad that we're going to celebrate them reaching this successfully reaching their five-year commitment.
Thank you. Mr. Asher?
Madam Mayor, I would like to move that we approve the Park Board recommendation to accept funding for the 2017-18 pilot program to manage Jasper's Dog Park, while pursuing strategies to ensure a sustainable source of funding for off-leash dog areas in the future.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Councilmember Sweet, to accept the Parks Board recommendation to accept funding for a 2017-18 pilot program to manage Jasper's Dog Park, while also pursuing strategies to ensure a sustainable source of funding for off-leash dog areas in the future. Any further discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And those opposed? Thank you very much. The motion is approved. Thank you, Mr. Asher. The next item on our agenda is under new business. Thank you, Jason. It's 11B, the Walkable Kirkland Initiative and Approval of the Neighborhood Safety Program Projects. City Manager.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Mayor. So there's a variety of topics that we're going to be talking about tonight, but the action that we need out of you is the approval of the neighborhood safety projects that have come through the Neighborhood Safety Program. But we're also going to be talking about some of the other Walkable Kirkland elements that the council has authorized, and some pretty good success stories over the last few years. So Here to give you that is Kari Page, our Neighborhood Services Coordinator.
Thank you. Well, it's exciting to be here tonight to talk to you about Walkable Kirkland. We've made a lot of progress, thanks to the City Council, on this matter. I am standing here giving a report based on work that others have done. So I want to point one person out in the audience, Marius Eugenio, who works on school walk routes with us. And he manages all the school walk routes. He'll be here to answer those questions. But he's also really done really good work to up the bar on our technical evaluation of projects that spreads all these different programs. So, and then there's a number of other people, George Manassian, David Snyder, Rod Steitzer, Joel Funt, Kathy Robertson, Iris Cabrera, and Lane Kawioka. And that's our team. So I'll be talking about four different programs tonight. Neighborhood Safety Program, you know, started in 2014 as part of the council's work program for re-energizing neighborhoods. The school walk routes that received a boost in funding in 2017 to 2022 in the CIP. And then the crosswalk initiative that was funded in part by the 2012 streets levy. And then, of course, the Cross Kirkland Corridor, when you got to bring that in when you're talking about Walkable Kirkland. And so we'll talk about some connections that we're doing there. And then, so at the end of the Neighborhood Safety Program presentation, we'll step through all the projects and we'll ask for a formal acceptance or change of our staff recommendation on the funding for 2017. So as you know, the neighborhood leaders and staff created the Neighborhood Safety Program, and they have a number of goals here. It's not just about making important safety improvements. It's also about re-energizing neighborhoods and increasing participation on neighborhood associations and increasing collaboration within neighborhoods, between neighborhoods, and with City Hall. Our funding sources are $150,000 from the streets levy, and then, of course, Walkable Kirkland, $200,000 a year through 2020. And then, as you have seen in past memos and whatnot, that we also pull on development fees. In fact, we've, in the last 3 or 4 years, had about $100,000 from development fees, and then other city programs, another $300,000. And then three RFBs are being funded through grants that we've received. So we kick off the Neighborhood Safety Program in the fall, and we have our goal of coming to you in the spring. And we were here in May last year. We're coming a month earlier. We kind of pushed it up a month this time and found ourselves doing a lot of the back and forth with the neighborhoods during the holiday season, so we're going to kind of change that this year. We're actually going to start the back and forth with the neighborhood associations in the spring. We'll still be coming, I'm talking about this spring, so we'll be starting to work with them in April and May before they go off on their holidays for the summer. And then, but still we'll target coming back here in April the next year. So in your packet, you'll see a number of these flowcharts for each of the programs, just kind of outlining how they are, how the decisions are made. As you know, ideas for the Neighborhood Safety Program comes through a multitude of sources, plan update processes, studies, other agencies, and then the interactive suggest a project database. And so what we do is we go through and categorize those, and we pull out the emergencies, the maintenance and operations, things that other agencies do, and some of the things that no action is required. And we give the neighborhood associations those lists that are categorized. And they go through and they prioritize these, and they give us their top two projects first, and we go back and forth, giving them the scope and budget on that, and then they come back with an application. And then in March of this year, we did the prioritization with the staff panel and the neighborhood panel. And then we go to the Transportation Commission, and that was done just last month. And then it all comes back in to the CIP group and our walkable Kirkland group, where I always say the magic happens. We start looking at other projects in the CIP, how we can match some of these projects to leverage our neighborhood safety program funding.
Question for you, Kari. Mr. Yep. Asher.
Yeah. How does the Transportation Commission play in this? Do they change priorities or projects? Or
they
like
haven't
that?
Yet. They okay. haven't yet. But they like to hear about them. They really are interested in our prioritization.
Okay.
You know, the technical, that we step through every single item with them on that.
Okay.
And we do that every year because we change it every year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So for 2017, in your packet, you have this list of projects. You see that we've done it a little differently this year. We've given cost estimate ranges instead of exact dollar amounts. We're only at a 5 to 10% design on these at this point. So we've gotten ourselves into a little bit of trouble when we've gone to 50 and 100% design. So now we're giving you a range, and we have three categories, things that we think are really likely to be funded. They're called top priorities. And then moderate, we hope to get to, and then the lower priorities, it's very doubtful we'll make it that far. This year, unique to other years, we have a lot of electrical projects. We have two rapid flashing beacons and five radar speed sign locations with nine different signs. So we're hoping to specialize during our bid process to be able to get a better price on those. So what I'll do is...
Oh. Just a yep. quick question. Sorry, just can you go back to that list real quick? So, you know, there's a number of projects that are, you know, run up against that 50,000 limit. So where are we on exploring, you know, perhaps modifying that cap? Is that something that we're going to be looking at this next year? Just because, you know, costs are increasing. We're seeing it across the board from all our, you know, capital projects.
Yeah. I'll let... Kurt answered that. I'm just going to say, though, we are also looking at ways to lower the costs a lot, too.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's a way that we've been working at it. But.
Okay.
So in your current adopted budgets, we would not be changing the cap, but that's something we'd look for policy direction from the council for. You know, clearly, if you added more, you could do more, but that'd have to come from somewhere.
Well, yeah, I think it's I agree with you that we'd like to lower the costs, I think, but it's also that there's other projects that, you know, can't be applied for, and maybe that's why we're seeing a preponderance of, you know, radar speed signs and RFBs mm-hmm. is because the walkways and the trails and things like that
yeah.
tend to, you know, go above that limit.
Right.
So I'd like for us to consider that.
Okay, so what I'll do is walk through these projects really quickly. Touching on each one, feel free to stop me and answer or ask questions. The first top priority is a radar speed sign on Northeast 143rd. This is in the Kingsgate neighborhood. It's on a school walk route. There is a hill there. People are speeding down the hill going from Safeway to Woodinville, or you might say 405 all the way to Woodinville is the east-west arterial. The second priority is a rapid flashing beacon, and this is just north of the Juanita Village Shopping Center. It's on a busy arterial, and it's a high, densely packed area with commercial development as well as multifamily complexes and even senior centers, or not centers, but senior housing. There's already an island here and the ADA ramps that we would have to install, and there's lighting. So we're saying that this beacon will be between $35,000 and $50,000. It's a little less than some of the other ones we've done that we've had to do that work for. And a crosswalk improvement, and this is between Thoreau Elementary School and Big Fin Park. It's actually crossing Northeast 138th Street. Kids stop there as they're walking on the school walk route, and they want to cross to get to the school, but parents are zipping in and out and taking a right there, and they don't have any place to stand. So we'll be putting a curb in and or delineators just to make it safe for the kids to stand. And the next one is a rapid flashing beacon. No, this is not a rapid flashing beacon. Sorry, I've titled this wrong. Radar speed signs. This is on 68th in the just... east of the Houghton Shopping Center, As you're going up 68, there's a corner there. We've had some accidents. In fact, somebody has even landed in a living room as they tried to round that corner. It's on a school walk route. We will be putting some reflectors on the curb. And then the panel wanted us to try out the radar speed signs to see if they'd work first, to see if they'd slow the traffic down before we went to, install them there. I think they're concerned that there's so much traffic there, it's backed up so many times that they're not sure it would be that effective.
Mr. Usher,
so we try that out.
Question is the picture here right and the graphic incorrect? Is
yes, that's what it is.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm thinking.
I added that later.
The pictures looks like 68, but the graphic wasn't.
The pictures are reversed.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. No sweat.
You so said
going into somebody's
picture.
Living room. I said, hang on.
And so let me go back. Yeah, I added these later, previous. Okay. So this is a rapid flashing beacon on 116th. And this is out by the McDonald's. And do you know where that is? You're coming down the hill, and a lot of cars are going fast, and people are walking from McDonald's to the shopping area.
Is this the picture?
Oh, this is the picture.
Wasn't right.
See, I got those two. I added those two later, and I reversed them.
Kari, is that that Totem Lake project? Is that the first Totem Lake project to be?
Yes.
Yeah. Proposed to be funded.
Yep. Yeah,
that's good.
I don't want to advance. Okay, so the next one. Think about the last picture. The next one is a radar speed sign on Northeast 68th Street. And if you look back on that picture, it's rounding that corner there. And this is where the panel is not sure about how effective these radar speed signs will be, so we were going to try some temporary ones first.
I couldn't figure out how do you do a temporary one?
It's the trailer.
It's not the big trailer.
Yeah, it is the big trailer. Yeah.
I would think that a big trailer would have a materially different effect.
Than the permanent ones?
Yeah, than just a speed sign.
Yeah.
Maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
So, Kari, to Mr. Pascal's point, I had asked you about that before and asked Kurt about that before, that because Totem Lake doesn't have a strong neighborhood association, but we did have, I thought, a mechanism for considering projects
yes.
in the Totem Lake neighborhood.
Yes, we do.
Can you explain how that worked?
Yeah. So when we do the suggested project database, we send out all the suggestions to all the neighborhoods. And staff will look through all the ones in Totem Lake and make a proposal.
Okay.
So we've pulled a couple out every year. This one actually came from somebody who mm-hmm. manages the flags out here and wrote in to one of you
yeah.
on the council, I think, for it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so we put it on, and then Johanna Palmer, who lives in Kingsgate or Evergreen Hill, saw it and actually wrote the application for it, because she thought it was a good idea. So staff didn't even have to do the application. We had enough support from
so
the community.
So we do have a way that if you have a really organized neighborhood association and you have a really poorly organized neighborhood association, some sort of geographic equity for the whole city to get projects
yeah.
approved.
We do not
do
have
think?
That. It was a decision that was made by the neighborhood association leaders that helped us design the program, and I should have brought that out in one of the goals.
Okay.
They said the goal is to be equitable, not equal.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to do the top priority projects that come forward
mm-hmm.
and not distribute it throughout the city equally.
Hmm.
So it'll be up to us to look through those and pull things out of the suggested project database when we have a dormant neighborhood association. Like in Lakeview right now, it's not real active.
Yeah, I think we should think about that, because there's a lot of needs in Totem Lake,
mm-hmm.
and there
yeah.
can be more. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Arnold.
Yeah, and one other issue is, as staff pulls things in the future, the way that the neighborhoods are set up, neighborhoods like Market and Norkirk and Highlands each could submit multiple projects,
mm-hmm.
and Finn Hill gets to submit two projects. And so want to make sure that if there is other projects
that you're aware of in the larger neighborhoods that per neighborhood association doesn't become a gate into determining needs for some of our larger neighborhoods. Mm.
Yeah, okay. Thank you for saying that.
Okay, the next project is intersection improvements on Kirkland Way and Railroad Ave. I know you've heard about this intersection before. It was a top priority last year to study it. And the recommendation from our consultants is to put a turn lane in on Kirkland Way as you're headed west. And then to come down to go southbound on Railroad Avenue, you will go around this island that's raised. But has a rolled curb so that if a big truck goes down and sees that they can't get through the bridge, they can still go down south on Railroad Ave. And so you'll have an opportunity to stop on that turn lane and let the cars keep going behind you while you wait for a break in the traffic to turn south. And then going out of the neighborhood northbound, we have two places to stop. One, if you're turning left, that's protected with a stop sign, and then one if you're headed north on Kirkland Way.
Mr. Asher?
Just something that comes to mind here just because of the picture that's up there. Can we put on our CIP a suspended ring at Kirkland Avenue somewhere too? That we really don't have any answer for it, and we just sort of drive through it and
right.
Close our eyes. So if we could stick that somewhere on a project list that we might address in the next 20 years, it'd be nice.
And then finally, added by the Neighborhood Safety Panel, they asked us to put some wayfinding signage here for pedestrians and bicyclists to get to the CKC so that people don't attempt to go through this narrow passage. So we are adding that to the project. Another intersection improvement that was a high priority last year that got designed by a consultant team and brought back and now is being funded through the 2017 program is at 124th Avenue and Northeast 80th Street. That's southbound 124th coming to 80th. There's a lot of backup there, and cars were squeezing in between each other while kids going to the high school and elementary school were crossing. So the consultants looked at this, and they narrowed up the connection for pedestrians crossing, and they moved the crosswalk back 7 feet, and they put in a bicycle lane painted green that leads you up to the intersection just to keep the cars in single file there. And the next one is radar speed signs on 95th near 127th. This is over by Mark Twain Elementary School. And this is the first in the second tier of projects. And so this would just slow parents down from taking their kids and dropping them off while kids are walking along the street here. And then there's another radar speed sign. This is just one, so this is the only one that has one. And it's going southbound as you're going down the hill on 90th, we call Albertson's Hill. So that's 90th Avenue Northeast. Just slowing cars going down there. Oh, and another piece of that is the broken extruded curb that's on this got referred over to the maintenance program to repair. And then this is 7th Avenue. There's a continuous sidewalk on the south side of 7th Avenue, but on the north side there are, in this particular location, some difficulties for people living on the north side to get to the crosswalk, to get to the sidewalk on the south side. So as you can see here, there's rocks and boulders, and so this would be removing those boulders and putting in a sidewalk. What compounds this walkway issue is that we have those traffic islands. And so when people come out walking on the road side of this red curb, they're encountering cars going around that traffic island, so it can be pretty dangerous. So since this is in our second tier, what we'll be looking at doing is doing a gravel walkway here, just clearing these big boulders and that and putting in gravel if we can afford that. And another one is similar. This is down in the Moss Bay neighborhood. There's a big residential area that gets to the Cross Curtain Corridor through this little alley, and it's right next to Ferriton Spur. It's one lane, of you can get two cars through, but you really have to go slowly. And if you're getting two cars through, you certainly can't have somebody walking on the street as well. So what we'd be doing is where the garbage cans are there is removing the big rocks that have been put in and the garbage cans, putting in gravel and probably some delineators there that will stop people from parking in that location so that pedestrians have a place to walk. Excuse me.
Okay. Will it stop people from putting garbage cans up?
Yeah.
No, I just question. I mean,
right. That's a good point.
Have to have a place to put them.
Yeah. Maybe we should ask them to relocate those. Yeah. So I'm hoping that we can still do something even with volunteers. Maybe not $1,000 on this. Note that this $1,000 to $14,000 is the lowest category. It doesn't mean that we think that we can get some of these smaller projects done for $1,000, but we might be able to work with volunteers to do those. And then I think this is the last one of the mid-tier, and that is radar speed signs on Waverly. This neighborhood has been working with the Neighborhood Traffic Control Program to get these, and we don't know where those will be at this point. So the lowest tier, we have street light, and this is at 3rd Avenue. As you come up the steps, that's where 6th and the CKC cross, you know where that RFB is. And so there are a lot of foliage here and that, and it's really dark. So we'll work with the neighborhood, not the association, but the homeowners association to see if we can get a solar light in. That's what we did at 60th and the CKC. That will be a cost savings. And there is a boardwalk. Have any of you been to this? Yeah, I didn't even know it existed. It's at the end of 111th Avenue in Highlands. It was built probably by a development, and it needs some repair. And then it's slippery and it's when it's wet, so we'll be putting down some non-skid surface on it as well. So we've kicked this one over to maintenance. So hopefully they'll be able to do something there. And then the final project, you can't tell by this picture, but it's put a hand railing in. This is really steep, and it's a walkway that just kind of cuts through a neighborhood and gets you to the Cross Curtain Corridor and up to, you know, elementary school and the middle school.
Just a quick
question, Mr. Pascal.
You mentioned the streetlight. Where are we on? Weren't we going to be looking at? I mean, I know the streetlights, they don't rank very high compared to other projects.
Yeah.
Where are we at on that streetlight program? Where we're going to kind of look at dedicating some funding for streetlights? Was that something that we were looking into?
Professor Dugan, complete blank on that one. So.
Oh. Okay. So I think it went through the budget process this last budget round.
What did we set aside?
Maybe talking about taking
and
over
it didn't,
the street lights.
Didn't
that we did.
Make it.
No, not taking over. It's just like through the neighborhood safety program, neighborhoods have identified the need for street lights in certain locations, but then we say, well, you know, we don't have a program to install street lights. You should apply through this program, but then they always rank at the bottom of the list and so never get implemented. So
Mr.
I was
Nixon
just asking.
Comment on this.
Was that? So, I mean, this is something I've been working on for a while because we have some areas up in Kingsgate that need streetlights. And what we've been talking about is simplifying the application process because currently it requires a lot of legwork on the part of whoever it is that wants to get the light put in. You have to get a petition signed by every homeowner who's within 100 feet of the proposed light location. And it's pretty complicated. And I think that's on the list for our Public Works Committee to look at over time, but we're kind of waiting for staff to come back to us with some information on that. And I don't know that we had talked about the funding side of it yet, but we've certainly talked about the process side of it.
Okay. Thank you.
So does that answer your question? It's with the committee to be discussed?
Yeah.
Good.
We'll make a note of it.
Yeah,
I've got it down as a note.
Thank you. You're the chair of that committee, right?
That's correct.
Perfect.
Yes. We will handle
it's all
it.
Falling into place. Yes, sir.
I was just going to make I move to approve the Neighborhood Safety Program list of recommended projects for 2017.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Pascal and seconded by Councilmember Asher to approve the Neighborhood Safety Program projects for 2017. Any further discussion?
It's a great process. Yes. I like the way the involvement. I don't know extending it out before. I'm sure that there's good reason for that before the summer. But at least it gets folks engaged, and it gives opportunities even for dormant neighborhoods to revitalize and to begin engagement. So it's the kernel of what was left over in a more robust neighborhood support program that maybe one of these days will go back and reinstitute. It's a good program, and I think we need to keep it going as strongly as we can.
Great. Thank you for your hard work on this, Kari. I mean, it's easy to. I hope I didn't sound critical. I think this is one of my favorite things we've ever worked on the council. I mean, people love it. They can solve problems. It's got a budget. It's specific. It's allows them to get to a granular level of where they live and how to make it a better place. And that's just what we're supposed to be doing as a city government, I think. So I absolutely love the thing. It's really wonderful work. So thank you so much. And I am interested in Councilmember Pascal's question or comment about if the costs go up, then do we increase the budget? And what if a project is really great, but it's $60,000? How do we do that? And when do we have that conversation? In the budget process? Is that when do
we have it in the budget process. I mean, every year at the end, we do a reevaluation of the neighborhood safety program. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we could bring back and say, here's potential changes. But in the end, you'd have to decide to add more money if you wanted to. And that would be the budget process.
And then
process.
What would we have to? What would be the trade-off?
Right.
So that is the budget process. Okay. And I think I'm going to turn the Totem Lake conversations into a suggest a project. Mm-hmm. For
good.
The Totem Lake.
Very good.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Yes, Mr. Asher.
One area that has come up during this process has been the review of the safe school walk routes. We're coming to complete the ones we committed to in 2002 here 2 years from now. So a career's worth of investment in safe school walk routes. I think it's probably high time that we start another process with a larger city to begin to investigate what are the high priorities for each of the neighborhoods so that we can, at the end of 2019 and 2020, we can begin on another 20-year list of projects so that we can improve the school walk routes for our kids. That's not a current thing to get going, but it's going to take a while to get it spun up. And I just think that with the new neighborhoods, it's worth doing, and it will be timely.
All right. That's part of Kari's upcoming presentation, mm-hmm. too, so we have a few more things to talk about.
Okay.
Well, I might as well just chime in just to head off a question here. But I think I agree with you, Mr. Asher. I think the other thing to recognize is that the school district, redistricted some of the boundaries of elementary schools, and that did change some of the school walk routes, mm-hmm. too, last year. So we do want to be mindful of that. And so I think it would be a good time to relook at that and, you know, a citywide view.
Great.
Got it.
Okay.
Please thank you.
Proceed,
so at
Kari.
The end of each one of these sections, I'm going to give you what we're calling a report card, and it's just showing what's been done and what's planned and what's under construction. So these are the neighborhood safety projects since 2014 when we did our pilot. These are the ones that are complete. And then the orange ones are in construction now. Most of those are 2016 projects, with the exception of the Forbes Creek connection to the CKC, which is in construction right now. Yay. And then the blue are what's being proposed for 2017. Now we'll go on to school walk routes. So school walk routes, the plans for those, the biggest deal is the active transportation plan that calls for all school walk routes on collectors and arterials to have one side of the side with a sidewalk on all of those arterials and collectors by 2019. The transportation master plan calls for a method to prioritize these sidewalks. We've been doing that as part of the neighborhood safety program, and like I was mentioning, that Marius is helping us score all of the sidewalk requests that come in. And we have a master database with those now. And the other interesting thing is the transportation master plan says that an extruded curb is not a sidewalk. So if there's an extruded curb, we would be that would be a deficient area. So the capital improvement program was generous to school walk routes in 2017 and 22. When you add the 16s, we have $4.1 million. And then starting in 18, we have another million for just the Juanita, Finn Hill, Kingsgate area. The 4.1 is citywide. And then, of course, we did a map. Actually, it was interesting. We had all private development sidewalks that put in on school walk routes, and there's a number of them that are getting infilled just as development happens. And our schedule is based on our goal, which means that we will do all of the 2001 commitment by 2019. Now, how many of you know about that process? I know Dave Asher does. Yes, it was an extensive process. We identified something like 55 different improvements that needed to be done. 38 of those were sidewalks. 32 of those sidewalks are done, and we have 6 sections left. So there are other sections within arterials and collectors that don't have a sidewalk on one side, both in the city, old city, and in the new neighborhoods. And we'll look at a map of that in a minute. But what we'll be doing, because they will score better with our grant funding, we found the ones that are left in that 38 are kind of the lower priorities and don't compete well with the state funding. So we'll be going after grants with the others. That's my point here. And the funnel, again, just showing the decision-making process for school walk routes goes through the capital improvement program that's updated every 2 years. So the council will have an opportunity to look at these again for the 2019-24 CIP. And you've seen in your packet the list of the commitments for 2019, and they add up to 4.3. These are really high-level cost estimates, and as we get to design, we will know more how close we are with the amount of money that we have. And then there's a list of projects, too, that, like I said, are on school walk routes, on collectors and arterials, but don't have, that are missing sections. And if you look at those around the city, there's about $2.3 million that we need to fill those, and that includes the new neighborhoods and the old. And then it doesn't include the extruded curbs. Those would need to be thrown in there, too. We haven't estimated all those. And it also does not include the neighborhood-identified school walk routes that we get every year at the end of Neighborhood Safety Program. We always ask the neighborhoods to tell us what their top priorities are. And they're often not on collectors and arterials. They're on neighborhood streets. So let me show the report card for this, and it kind of helps explain what we're talking about. It's hard to move this mouse. Sorry. Okay, so these are the 2001, we call them, you know, the committed list, promised list. And the black now is what we've completed. That leaves 6 pieces left. We will be going, we are going into design on all the blue ones in 2017, and that one small 126th area, we'll be going to construction in 2017 on that one. And then by 2019, we will have that list complete. I don't know if that means December 2019 or... Do I hear?
Under promise, over
delivery. Okay, as long as it's by the end of 2019. Okay. And then, and this map isn't great on the blow up here, but it shows extruded curbs, which is the double red line, and then the red line. Those are those last projects that are on arterials and collectors around the city that still are not on that list. That we'll be going after grant applications for.
Yes, Mr. Pascal, question, comment?
So are these where you've done an inventory and these are all the missing?
Yes, because, on collectors and arterials.
Yeah, because it seems like there's still some gaps here, because I know like Sandburg, it's still primarily extruded curb there along 84th, actually pretty much all the way down to 122nd. I know there are some sidewalks and stuff, so.
I was noticing that as I drove down. It might be that our GIS does not have that listed as extruded curb. We'll have to double check that.
I mean, it goes. It's actually a pretty long line there.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold.
One of the things that I'd like to see, given that the walkable Kirkland program, the funding goes through 2021, and. When you look at how much work it took to get the original 2001 list done, with Mr. Asher, pounding us every single budget cycle to say, when are we going to be able to declare victory and be complete? I'd be interested in seeing what is it that we can do for the identified ones, especially in the annexation area, to say what is it that we can do to be complete by the end of the walkable Kirkland program. To be able to say at least this set of red lines gets done.
So, Mr. Asher.
Yeah, my challenge with that is these are easily identifiable as deficiencies from an engineer's point of view. There may be other really high payoff things that the neighborhood and those that use those things on a daily basis know. I think we can walk in there and say, here's what we see as priorities, do they match yours? But I think getting out of City Hall into the neighborhood is the most high payoff investment that we can make, because those mothers, they know where they really need something. So that's why I would push for that above anything else.
So is that, how does that happen? Is that part of the, you got to reach the PTAs, right? Not just the neighborhood associations
That's this innovative staff. Yes. They know how to connect.
Okay.
We did it in 2001. Some of us are still here.
That's right.
Happy you are, Carmen.
So how that would probably play out is a, small budget into 2019-20 budget to set up that process, which would then result in a list of projects from 2020 on. So... That's the way we'd probably come back and do it.
Well, so there's the grant funding that happens in 2018, and it's every biennium that grant program by the state is put out. So we have to start preparing for those 2018 right. applications now. And I guess the question would be, we have priorities of the school walk routes for the ones that aren't on the 2001 list. Are those our priorities, or are those prioritized based upon which would most likely compete well for grants?
Yeah, that's a great question.
So, because you can look at it two different ways.
Yes.
It could be our priorities, or we could go, wait, let's look at the projects that actually might get funded with the grants.
And the good news is, Marius, on that, he has taken our prioritization process and looked at the states, even gone to the states' data sources for their prioritization process and aligned it with ours. So it should be, I don't think that it's identical, but it's definitely trying to reflect the states.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. So now we're going on to the crosswalk initiative. This was mostly funded through the voter-approved street levy. In 2013 and 14, we doubled up the $150,000 for each of those years. in the pedestrian safety category and in the school walk route grant category, which gave us $600,000 to do rapid flashing beacons. And our street levy goal was to do 50 rapid flashing beacons in 20 years. And then the transportation master plan said go through and find a method to prioritize these and fund them based on that prioritization process, which we have been working on and gets improved, like I said, every year. The other thing that we are doing is looking at when we would use, when we would jump to rapid flashing beacons and when we would start at making sure that you have adequate lighting. We might start with pedestrian flags first. We might shorten the crossing distance for pedestrians, et cetera, before we get to the rapid flashing beacons. So we're looking at that as well. There is a lot of funding, again, a generous Walkable Kirkland funding out of the Capital Improvement Program for crosswalks. There are projects like 116th and 132nd Avenue, as well as the Neighborhood Safety Program, We Need to Drive Quick Wins. And we're also able to get some projects done through development fees or development projects near developments. And as just wanted to point out in this that you can get these funded either through the Neighborhood Safety Program or through the Capital Improvement Program. What we did is use the Federal Highway Association's prioritization for crosswalk improvements. As the number of lanes go up and vehicle speeds and volumes increase, so do the risks for crashes at intersections. So we use that criteria on our crosswalks. These are mid-block crosswalks to set priorities. And so we have red is first priority, yellow is second, and blue is third. We went through all of our crosswalks, and we have a map that shows every single one and what their rating is. So we have five red ones. Those are just replacing the in-pavement flashers that you know have are very difficult to maintain and have had some problems. And then the yellow is the second. So of those five, by the way, one will be replaced as part of the Lakefront Pedestrian and Bicycle Project. We have 10 that fall into the second category. Two of those are going to get RFBs by development. One is going to be the Lakefront Pedestrian Project, and the Neighborhood Safety Program is doing one. So four of those are being addressed in the near future, probably 2017. And then we have 19 that are in the blue. And now in the blue, we probably wouldn't just immediately go to rapid flashing beacons, but we have CIP projects for 116th, which there are four on, and then the Neighborhood Safety Program is doing one as well. So these are ticking away. And great. Then I'll show you the report card on this for our levy goal of 50. So these are the 50, actually these are 32 of the 50 that we identified locations for when we did the levy. And then we said 18 more will be done at different locations as they come up. And so right there shows that we've done 28 since the levy, and we did 10 just prior to the levy. So that's included in here as well. So that's really 38 that have been done. Are you with me? And then when you add the cross-Kirkland Corridor 7, that means we've done 35 or 45. And then when you look at what's planned, both by grants and neighborhood safety and some private development, we will have done about 54, possibly by the end of 2017. So we'll be beyond our goal, 20-year goal.
All right.
Questions?
No questions.
Do it good.
Get on with it, they say.
Very
one
thorough.
More. This is the shortest, cross-Kirkland Corridor. As you know, making connections is a goal, and it's been a high priority since we opened the trail in 2015. We get the funding from the Emergence Opportunity Fund, as well as money that was left over in the interim trail. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. We had some savings there. We've been pulling on that. We fund some through neighborhood safety, and then there's private development that funds some. I provided a list of those projects in your council packet, and I'll just show you quickly what those are and what we have planned. So those are the complete ones, and we have a couple that are in the works as part of the neighborhood safety program, and then some that we still want to do. You know, the South Kirkland Park and Ride, of course, the Totem Lake Connector, and then we have a couple others. 116th in Totem Lake, we'd like to make that connection. And there's one at the North Crestwoods Park entrance that we want to do. Mm-hmm. So those are the ones we've identified. Some more will come up, positively. So that ends my presentation. Mm-hmm. Sorry that it was so long. There's four different programs that we were reporting
on. No, that's a lot of work. Thank you very much, John.
I was just going to say that was a great presentation. The maps are super helpful. So do we have plans to post those
Website?
I mean,
great
I think
idea.
The public would really enjoy looking at those.
Okay.
And really kind of showcases what we've been doing. So.
Thank you. Other comments or questions for Kari?
I'd go the next step and get them out to the neighborhood associations.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Publish them so they can show them at their meetings.
Okay.
You can just send that presentation out. That's great. Thank you very much, Kari. That was excellent.
Thank you.
That feels like good, productive work.
Yep.
All right. The next item on our agenda is council reports. Mr. Nixon.
I have a few things this time. First, events. Several of us attended the Kirkland Fire Awards ceremony on the 24th of March, recognized our Firefighters of the Year and promotions and significant anniversaries and such, and that was a very nice event. And then we also had the Youth Eastside Services breakfast and the Together Center breakfast recently. The thing I want to talk most about, though, is the Regional Law, Safety, and Justice Committee meeting that was on March 23rd, and I sent you a report in email. There were two basic topics at the meeting. One of them was an update on the heroin and opiate addiction task force recommendation, which we've pretty much already heard. The other was new, and the city of Auburn has this program that they've created called Mental Health First Aid. I don't know if you read my explanation in the report or not, but basically, it's training people on what they should do if somebody in their family or classroom, at work, whatever, has kind of a mental health incident. What they're trying to do is make this knowledge of what to do in a situation like that as ubiquitous as CPR. I thought this was a fascinating idea, and I'd like us to get more information about it and see how we could implement it in Kirkland. So I would like to ask to have an investigation of this and a recommendation assigned to one of our council committees. I'm not sure which one, though. It could be public safety. It could be Parks, Public Works, and Human Services, because it's kind of a human services thing. Or we could just put it on the list, anticipating that we will soon have a human services commission and let them look at it. But I'm open to suggestion. I would just like us to look deeper at what Auburn is doing and see if we could do something similar here.
Yes, Mr. Asher.
Evergreen Hospital is got something, I think, in the next week on the task force on mental health first aid. So they are actively engaged in it already. Let me ship. I'll get some information to you. But I think that this will fit. With our Human Services Commission, absolutely.
Thank you.
So should we say that we'll follow up on what Evergreen's doing and then refer it to the Human Services Commission
it
for follow-up?
Sounds like it. Mm-hmm.
Okay. In terms of things that are coming up, looking at my calendar, I show that we have our council meeting with the Everest neighborhood here on Tuesday, April 11th, so a week from tonight. Is that still on? It's still on. We have a business roundtable on Wednesday the 12th. The State of the City address for the Kirkland Alliance of Neighborhoods in the Peter Kirk Room on the 13th.
That's actually going to be rescheduled.
That's going to be rescheduled.
Yes, their request.
Okay. And then we have a, I think we still have a Fire Academy graduation ceremony on April 14th at Lake Washington High School. Yep. So those things coming up.
Any of these things?
Oh, I'll be happy to forward them to you. Okay. Yeah. There's no SCA Public Issues Committee meeting in April, so we have nothing to prepare for there. The last thing I want to mention is that I applied for and was selected to be on a task force organized by the Public Disclosure Commission to look at improvements to their website, specifically the search functionality.
Oh, good. Yeah. Good for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I'm a masochist. But if you have any ideas of improvements to the PDC website that you would like me to share with them, I'd be happy to do that.
It's so funny that I asked you for your help with that this evening.
Yes.
Yes. That's great.
That's all I have.
Thank you. Mr. Pascal.
Thank you. So the Public Works, Parks, and Human Services Committee committee meets tomorrow morning. So nothing to update you on that. So on March 22nd, I attended the Finn Hill Neighborhood Alliance general meeting. I was there along with our county council member, Rod Dombowski. And we fielded questions, and there was a number of questions about the landslide in Big Finn Hill Park. There's still a lot of concerns about that, and been talking with Public Works about getting communication out on that. The other thing that I was able to do on March 23rd was to spend some time at the police department. Got to go to some of the shift changes and introduce myself to the patrol officers. Woke up early one morning and was there at 6:30. So that was nice to see and meet more officers. And then finally, on March 29th last week, city manager and I attended a meeting with the school district, the superintendent, and a couple of the board members, and talked about things of mutual interest, and specifically the construction activities going on with the schools, Juanita High School, the school city playfield partnership, some of those sites that we might be considering for investment, and then the school resource officer and when those officers might get back into the high schools. So that's it.
Thank you. Mr. Asher?
I would like to announce that I have participated in a mid oversight committee accountability and evaluation subcommittee. They are in fact progressing and moving forward to talk about outcomes and measuring things.
Congratulations.
And of the $60 to $70 million that we spend each year, they might even spend some money on how you measure things.
That's
sometime in the
by
future.
You.
It was absolute delight to be there, and I think we've got some folks that might be serious. So, yay!
Yes, yay, you.
That's all I have.
Thank you. Ms. Sweet.
Not much from me. Attended lunches, lots of breakfast. Together, yeah. Center, Youth East Side, Lake Washington School District. And that luncheon is the most efficient thing in the whole free world. I really can't believe how efficient it is. And also participated in the March for Justice. I think Mr. Pascal was there, as was Mr. Arnold. I think it was 250 to maybe 300 people total gathered. The most impressive thing were the police officers. And I want to thank Sherry. If you could have seen her, she walked the event with everybody. She was available for questions. She was so engaging. I got so much feedback in terms of, wow, she's doing this with us. And it was, people were really impressed, Sherry, so I just want to shout out, you're pretty amazing. Thank you.
I second that. Thank you. Mr. Arnold.
On Saturday, March 26th, or yes, on Sunday, March 26th, I spoke at the Indivisible Kirkland Kenmore Group. They wanted a local government 101, and we're looking at ways to harness this energy and get involved. And I talked about our the way that local government works, our boards and commissions, neighborhood associations, and even suggested running for office, given the deadline coming up on May 19th. So that was a lot of fun talking to them. On Friday the 31st, I attended King County Sound City's presentation on immigration and refugee issues. I sent around my notes around to all of you, but a lot of great information there on work that we should be doing. And the good news is we are really ahead of the curve with the work that we did last month with passing our ordinance. There are some follow-ups and best practices coming from the state's attorney general on how we can go implement those, but I'm really proud of the work that we've done, and I think it will serve us well.
Absolutely. Thank you. I attended my first Eastside Human Services Forum board meeting, and we had a presentation on immigration issues as well, and that is a very hot topic. I wanted to, Lori reported on my visits to Olympia, but I think the most interesting news that I think we need to think about how we engage with is the announcement by the mayor of Seattle that the homelessness property tax levy is not going to happen, and they're going to work on a homelessness services package that's King County-wide, but it feels as if it seems as if it's already determined that how it's going to be funded. And I'm just wondering how we can engage in that conversation and we're tracking it, obviously, but I think it's going to be important that we track it and are heard. I was hoping that there would be a discussion first before the funding mechanism was announced, but...
And what else we might have on the ballot at the same time, mm-hmm. like a fire station.
Mm-hmm. So, anyway, is that, how are we tracking that?
So, yes, we're...
It's hot news, I know.
Right, we read about it in the paper, too. Mm-hmm. So I actually had a call into Deanna Dawson yesterday, and she and I are playing phone tag, but we're going to talk tomorrow morning about how was SCA involved or not, and then how can SCA be involved through the process. It's also now a topic at our ARCH board meeting, which is coming up, to say how can the East Side engage this and the cities engage this. So I think everyone who's involved in homelessness and housing is going to want to know how to work on this. But we're still trying to find out the details. We don't really know much yet.
We did think that someday a housing levy would be a good thing, but I'm not sure this is exactly what that is.
It has, outside of Seattle, it has never polled anywhere close to being able to pass.
Mm-hmm.
That's the challenge. I don't know. Maybe the county has some new polling information, but that's been the ARCH challenge. Is we couldn't get East Side, and I don't know whether South County, but I know we looked at it from an ARCH point of view. Could never get polling numbers to even look anywhere promising.
It'll just be interesting. I've been a part of the Sound Cities conversation, but how cities are involved, how ARCH is involved.
Right.
This is a really big conversation, important one, and I just want to make sure we're tracking.
So. Definitely be a high priority for us.
Thank you.
But if we want our community to pass this, I think we're going to have to engage our community, mm-hmm. and it'll take about a year.
Exactly.
To have any impact.
And before we can do that, we need to know what
it is.
It'll do for us, for our community. Yeah.
Exactly.
But the good news is we just established our housing advisory committee for our housing strategies
task force, so that just got created, and now that we have this, we can take whatever information we have on it into that group. So yeah. There's a chance to get a group of Kirkland folks really engaged on that, but we need to learn more.
Yeah. Yep. We'll have to move quickly. Okay, thank you very much. That's the end of the council reports. City manager.
Okay, well, that was the housing one was my main topic as well, so you've already covered that. Just want to point out that we not just have the Everest neighborhood on April 11th, but the council retreat on May 9th is coming up, so that should be on all your calendars. This is the financial retreat, so please triple check that it's on there. And then at the last meeting, council expressed an interest in getting an update on the Route 255 restructuring, so I just wanted to point out that that's actually going to be your study session on May 2nd, so we did put that in. Were there any other changes or additions to the calendar that the council wanted to suggest?
I see none.
Okay, so that's all I have for tonight.
Thank you very much. Then it is before 10 p.m., so we have an additional items from the audience period. This is a time in our meeting when we hear from the public on matters which are not quasi-judicial or otherwise scheduled for public hearing on our agenda. Please limit your comments to 3 minutes. We also ask that not more than 3 people speak on any one subject. I'm going to ask anyone in the audience who'd like to address the council at this time. And seeing none, I will declare this item from the audience period closed and thank our staff and our council for an awful lot of good work tonight. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. Good night. We're adjourned.